All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and let everybody come in as they appear. We're going to go ahead and kick off. It is 1:05 p.m. on February the 17th, 2024. Welcome to Project GFK CSI Dallas Presents The Journey. I am your host, David Knight, and I want to welcome everybody that they got the email late for the meeting today. I'm really happy that you guys signed up and you're here with us. We've got some new information that's going to come out today, and also talk about the research of the JFK assassination. We're at 60-plus years now. We just finished up our Dallas conference back in November, and I want to let everybody know, please save the date. I want to talk about what's going to happen in Kansas City, at least in the Kansas City metro area, in April. We are going to be hosting a student symposium. Now, this is a little bit different than what is going to be what you're going to experience in Dallas or like what we did in Memphis. This is a student symposium. We talk about it all the time of getting the next generation involved. The idea that, you know, some of us that are a lot older, we don't want it to die with us. And we want to make sure that we're reaching the next group of researchers that's going to take and pick up the gauntlet and run with this. So we haven't had a student symposium in the Kansas area in quite a few years, but we're going to have one in April. It's going to be at Johnson County Community College, which is the college that I'm attending right now to get my degree in IT. And we've got about probably 3,000-plus students, and they range anywhere from the age of 18 all the way to, I think, the oldest one is probably in their 80s, whether they're taking continued education classes or earning a degree. So we're going to have it as an in-person event for those 2 days, a Friday and a Saturday. And the idea behind this, again, is to get, to get the younger generation involved and to have them hear speakers in person. And also I'm working on putting the Zoom portion together because I want to get this broadcast out to the world. And that way, in case we have some remote students that want to tune in, or maybe they're remote learners, they're not on campus, then they can also take part. And some of the speeches and lectures that we're going to have for you seasoned researchers, it's going to be stuff that you know, because you've been doing this for a long period of time. But if we all came in like we do in Dallas and everybody would be talking over the students' heads, you're going to see that glazed over look in their eye and they're going to tune out. So some of these presentations, whether they are 101 or even a 102 presentation or a 202 presentation, we're going back to basics on some of these presentations because we have to have a starting point for these, you know, young researchers that we want to hook into this. And it's not to hook in on a fact that we're trying to cult them and turn them. No, what we're trying to do is present the evidence that what was given to us by the Warren Commission, by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, way back in the 60s and the 70s, we are going on the research that we have found in the documents that's been released by doing 60 years of research. So this is a great opportunity to have speakers come out someplace other than Dallas, Texas. It's going to be on the Kansas. It's going to be in the state of Kansas. We're probably about 25-30 minute drive from the airport. We're kind of in the burbs. But if you look online, you look up the county of Johnson County, Kansas. It's a big county. It's one of the counties where it's a large group of dense population. It's not like we're going out to the sticks. We're reaching a new audience. We still are going to be doing Dallas. I know me and David Denton have already been speaking about putting on the Dallas conference this year. More details will come out on that. I'm hoping we will have some hardened.
It's about what you do in the dark room when it's you and your thoughts.
All right, that has one more time. He gets kicked out. I don't stifle free speech, but I don't have somebody interrupt our meetings. So, give me just a quick sec. And he's gone. Good. So anyway, getting back to that, we are going to be having information coming out for the Dallas 2024 conference that will be happening in November. We are working on a where we're going to land at, you know, as far as our hotel goes. Will we be going back to the same place we've been at the last 2 years, or are we going to be looking at going someplace else? So those details will be coming out, but I want to give you the details about...
Give up, you know, and
I'm going to make an announcement here. Please, everybody, keep your microphones on mute unless you're talking, so that way we don't have interruptions. So just hit your microphone mute button. And then if you'll raise your hand, I'll call on you. So anyway, we're going to be doing this April 12th and the 13th, 2024. There'll be updates coming out on the website. Now this is not going to be held at a hotel like we've done, you know, in years past, or like the Dallas conference. I'm going to be working on getting a rack rate on a couple close hotels. So anybody that wants to come in and show up in person, please do. I mean, that's gonna show the students that you know, there's more people you know, sitting beside them. They can answer questions. They can share the research and the ideas that they have done over the years. But we're not going to be holding at a hotel. You don't have to stay at the hotel that we get the special rate for. You're more than welcome to pick any hotel that you want to stay at. But at least that way we can have something on a cheaper basis for the people that are coming into the in-person part of the conference.
Oh,
All right, that guy's gone. Sorry, I just don't put up with shit with people interrupting. Unless you've got something good and you want to stay. But just to irritate, you're gone. So anyway, the details will be coming out. The speakers that we have so far that is a guaranteed booking for the April conference is going to be myself, Casey Quinlan, Brian Edwards, David Denton, Ed Tatro, and I want to reach out. I know Doug Horn is in the room. Doug Horn is going to be coming in and doing two presentations, one on Friday and one on Saturday. You are not going to want to miss Doug's presentations. The presentations will be listed by speaker, by time. This is going to be something that won't be a, you know, from morning until midnight type of event. We're going to start at 9 in the morning. We will go until 5 in the afternoon, 5 in the evening. And then for those that are in person, you'll have time to go out, you know, maybe, I don't know if the Royals are playing that weekend, but maybe if you want to catch a game, just explore the city and see what Kansas City has to offer. We want this to be educational, but then again, we also don't want to beat people over the head with taking way too long for a conference. Okay, speaking of Project JFK CSI Dallas, let me pull this up real quick. I do want to give an apology to the people that have been donating to us over the last couple months since we had our really long 6-hour event. It was a lot of fun doing it, but again, we're not going to go for 6 hours today, everybody. But hey, we had time and I had nothing to do that day, so 6 hours is not a bad thing. But for those of you that have donated and we did not get a chance to get you up on the board, you know, as far as our donations go, I do want to say thank you. I want to apologize for not getting your name up there sooner. But you can go to projectgfk.com if you're liking what we're doing and you want to donate to the cause. You can follow along with these people here that are on the list. Click that PayPal Donate Now button. It's a safe, secure way if you want to... you know, make a donation to us. It can be whatever you choose. That way we can keep the lights on, we can keep the program going. So I want to say again, thank you for those of you that have donated. And then I also want to make a quick announcement on our store tab. The new additions to that, the JFK Horseman book by Larry Rivera, the digital copy, the 2023 edition, is out now. It came out at the Dallas conference. If you want to order a copy, it's $30 for the digital download or $35 plus shipping and handling if you want a USB flash drive of your own. Also, the other book that has come out and is now in printing, Brian Edwards is not here with us today, and the reason why is because him and Gary Shaw and Ricky White are meeting down in Texas to sign autographed copies. But the book, the long-awaited book, is now out. You can get that at PenilUnlimited.com, and I also believe it is on Amazon. So if you want to get a copy of that, please pick it up. I have been reading that book, and it is it's a really great book. A lot of thorough research into the Roscoe White story, and you know, it's told in a different, I don't want to say a different direction, but in a enlightening direction of a family member that found out something about their dad that, you know, they've had to live with and also to experience in life. So again, the two new books that we are pushing is the JFK Horseman by Larry Rivera and also Admitted Assassin by Ricky White, as told by J. Gary Shaw and Brian K. Edwards. I do want to talk about another quick book. This one here is called Chokeholds. Let me pull that up real fast here. All right. The JFK assassination chokeholds that inescapably prove there was a conspiracy. This is the Kindle edition. It's also available in hardcover and paperback by James DiEugenio, Matt Crumpton, Paul Blau, Andrew, I believe it's Eiler, and it says one more. What's the one more? It's Mark Adamczyk. And we are looking at doing, I've been getting the emails from Andrew. I do want to do a special spotlight series on this book this year. I'd like to have it done before we have our April conference. So I see that Jimmy D is in the audience. Paul and Andrew are both in here. This is a book that I have not personally read yet. It is on my read list, and I will be getting a copy of it, so that way I'll be a little more intelligent when we do the spotlight series. While we've got those guys in the audience, and you guys are here today, why don't you give me a little bit of the backstory and give me kind of a lead up teaser of when we do the spotlight series. We'll kind of make this a little promotion period. Paul, Andrew, Jim, everybody wants, you guys can each, you know, take a moment and share some information about it. And then, we'll get off offline here. We will talk about when we can get this scheduled, because I know that I've had some people reach out and they've told me about the book. Plus I also had you know, some emails from Andrew about getting this scheduled. So it's something that's definitely on the to-do list. Paul, you want to start?
Yeah, why don't I? And Jim and Andrew, don't chime in if you want to. Thank you so much, David, for giving us this opportunity to say a few words. Before I start, I wanted to let you know that for your event in April, we did something similar in Quebec City, not for students, but sort of a novice audience. How do we adapt to the audience with the limited law knowledge they have? So if ever you want to pick our brains, the other thing that we did in Quebec City when we held a major event and had Oliver Stone up, is we got an awful lot of interest from the city for the economic aspect of it too. So I'd be happy to share with you and give you some ideas if it might help. chokeholds, JFK assassination chokeholds, about at the Kappa meeting a year and a half ago. I was with Jim DiGenio, and I had never met the other three authors, Matt Crumpton, Andrew Eiler, and Mac Adamczyk. But we had a discussion, and it had to do with, you know, how do we change the what's written in history books for students? It kind of started from there because I had done a study on how history books relate the JFK assassination. It was 10 years old, but I updated it. And the discussion brought us to a point where there's so much information coming to audiences that are sometimes reliable, sometimes not reliable. There's some good theories, quack theories. And, you know, so we were discussing the backyard photos. And I was asked, what do you think of them? I said, well, they're compelling. You know, there are certain things that make them very suspicious, but I don't consider that a chokehold. And then the question was, well, what is a chokehold? And I said, the chokehold is a word Malcolm Blunt used when he described the Betsy Wolfe analysis of Oswald's CIA files and how they were handled. You know, the fact that they hadn't opened up a 201 file immediately, and the fact that the file would not go to the Soviet Russia division, but went to the Office of Security. And at the end of that, he says, to me, that is a chokehold. Oswald wasn't a real defector. So that's where the word comes from. Now, in the book, we have 10 chokeholds. And the 10 chokeholds, we consider 10 areas of proof that are indisputable. And the way we wrote the book, you'll note that among the authors, three of them are lawyers. And then, of course, you have Jim, who has, I think, vast knowledge on, you know, what is, you know, what's outlandish out there. So there's an awful lot of quality control going into the book. Now, let me explain. We decided that, you know, the lawyers would reel us in. They would say, okay, well, describe this chokehold to us. And we would describe it and say, okay, well, what are your sources? And what does it mean? So we have an element of standards of proof in the book. So the standards of proof that we tried to attain was clear and convincing evidence that there was a conspiracy, and B, that Oswald would never have been found guilty beyond reasonable doubt. And Andrew Eiler and some of the other lawyers really wrote something fantastic around that notion. So that was what we brought into it. And if you, just to give you an idea, the first chapter is about what really is the official record. The official record, what we were able to demonstrate in that chapter was that really everybody who's on this Zoom call is much closer to what the official record is than the people who are often pundits on these shows and say that conspiracy theorists are whack jobs. So that, and we do that by showing what's written in the actual investigation reports, all six of them. And then we take 90 insiders, people like Richard Schweiker and people like Robert Tannenbaum, and we show what they are actually on the record of having said, Robert Blakey, you name them. Lawyers, police officers, what we call insiders. And anybody who goes beyond, who reads that chapter will say, hey, you know what? Who is really the conspiracy theorist in here? It's the lone nutters. That's a theory. So among the chokeholds that we have in there, we have proof that Oswald was impersonated at least 17 times. We have proof of a front shot, obviously. We show who Jack Ruby really was. So these are the things that if you were to try and find the best arguments for students to say, hey, look, what's written in that history book, ask your teacher these questions. Okay. Why was he, you know, why did this such a thing happen in Mexico City here? So we try and keep it real simple. Each chapter starts with an executive summary. So in other words, we will tell the reader right off, here's what you will learn in this chapter. Then we roll out the chapter, and at the end, the lawyers do sort of a summation. given this, ergo, there was. Okay, given this. And they do it point by point. So I honestly think that this is sort of, there's going to be a before and after chokeholds. What I mean by that, I'm not saying that, what I mean is if you read that book, and after that book, you still think there's a lone nut, you'll never change your mind. But if you read it and you're open-minded, you will never again believe that there isn't something more sinister than Oswald alone did and Ruby. So that's sort of the concept of chokeholds. We do not go into who committed. It's not about that. It's really a summation of 60 years of evidence that brings us up to today. And here's everything we've learned through the investigations, through the most recent releases. We bring it all the way up to Paul Landis. Okay, so the last chapter, and I'll end on this, now maybe Andrew and Jim want to chime in, but it's called 60 Years of Obstruction of Justice. That chapter alone is, like, it's a 420-page book. That chapter is 90 pages out of 10. Why? There was so much obstruction. It's amazing if you go from one to the next, and I don't know if it's ever been laid out that way. It's sort of laid out the way Sylvia Maher did, but only for the Warren Commission. We do it for all the investigations. The reactions have been fantastic so far. The book is doing quite well. And if you want to get a better idea of what's on it, somebody saw the Jeff Crudell show. And the other one is we just did a recent interview, Jim and myself, for Untold Stories with Mark Robert. Go and see that on YouTube, and you'll get a really good feeling of what is in there. And that's what I could, you know, maybe just a summary of what I can tell you about chokeholds. And I don't know if you have any questions or if Jim wants to chime in or Andrew.
Well, I tell you what, Paul. I've been reading the reviews on Amazon. It's got a 4.4 rating out of 5. There's 50 reviews on there, and I like the idea that it's something that where you touched on the fact of, you know, it's a book that the younger generation can go back to their teachers. Now, sometimes the teachers, unfortunately, especially with the way the curriculum is taught today, the students sometimes know more than the teachers do or outsiders do, and we've got to fix that. We really have to fix that narrative. This is something that, you know, the JFK assassination has affected everyone, not just the researchers that are in this room or the ones that come to a conference or the ones that write the books. The reason why you write the books is to get the people to pay attention to what is going on, what has happened, and where we have come from 1963 to today. And I'm excited to read the book. I need to get a copy picked up as soon as possible. And like I say, we're gonna have a spotlight series. Now, Paul, I don't know if you're familiar with our spotlight series videos and our evenings, but it's on the minimum of 2 to 3 hours, and the last hour is basically open to questions and answers. So this is one of those books that and one of the talking points that I think we need to bring into the conversation on a deeper level. You know, I know I haven't read the book yet, but I've read a lot of good things about it, and I've heard a lot of good things about it from other researchers that have read it that have inquired why I haven't picked it up yet. Unfortunately, there are only so many hours in the day.
Yeah.
But I know that Rick's got his hand up. Rick, do you have a question to Paul?
I just wanted to make a comment. I've not only read it, you can see here, it's, I don't know how well you can see, it's already marked up. And because I read Chokeholds, it's been a long time since I read the Warren Report. So I went on Amazon and I bought a copy of, it's hard to see here, I bought a hard cover copy of it. And here's what's pretty neat. When I got it, it says then, June 12th, 1965, love mother. So somebody's mother gave them a copy of the Warren Report back in 65. So, but the interesting thing about this book is I'm on Facebook, and sometimes I get in these discussions with people who are lone nutters, so to speak. And this book gives a great synopsis of to counter some of the crazy things you hear people say. And so I love the book. I'm reading it again a second time. So I want to thank all of you, the five authors of it, done a great job.
Well, thanks so much, Rick. David, if you don't mind, Paul's done a great job. I'm really glad he jumped on the show today. But I do want to say it's podcasts like this one, Project JFK, Dallas CSI. Matt Crumpton has an amazing podcast, one of the co-authors, Solving JFK, JFK, The Enduring Secret. I see Doug Campbell is here from Dallas Action and the Lone Gunman podcast. I think Paul's been on that before. There are so many amazing podcasts and YouTube channels. I think we could sit here for a few minutes and list them. And what they're doing is bringing this this important story and all of the ongoing research to the wider American public and world public. I'm up here in Canada, and I've got at least six or seven JFK podcasts and YouTube channels subscribed to, and I think the message that's getting out is just absolutely incredible. And I got to thank you guys for taking the time to produce such excellent content. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that, Andrew. I appreciate the kind words about that. I tell you what, guys, this is a team effort. I commend anybody that puts out a podcast or a show on the affiliated website page on our website. We list a lot of different places for people to go to. I mean, this is kind of the yellow pages of the research community. And for anybody that, visits the website, please go on there. And if you see that there needs to be something added to the affiliated website page, send me an email and let me get that website or that podcast or YouTube channel put on the to put on our website, so that way people can find them. Because unfortunately, I've noticed when it comes to the JFK assassination, there's so much. Hold on, just a second. There's so many times that there's great information, but if you don't know where to look for it, then it's hard to find. We average around 7 to 10,000 hits a day. On average, we're at least no less than 4,000 hits a day. And I want to let you guys know that if you want something to be picked up by other researchers, then this is the place, to have it posted. This is kind of, I don't want to say the one-stop shop, but I want to make it to where if people need to find, if you want them to find it, you have something you want them to hear or read, this is the place to put it. So please, again, if you have something that is not on there and it's missed my radar, then, reach out to me by email at projectjfk@yahoo.com. And send me a quick email and let me know, hey, this needs to be on the website, and I will go through and get them posted on there, and then that way when we talk about things here in the meetings, they can go straight to the site and find it. You guys as let's see, there's five authors on this book, is that right, Paul and Andrew?
Yeah, David, if there are five, and we have a website called jfkchokeholds.com. We started a Facebook. We're up to 126 followers. Please come on it. We will post, like a link to this episode. We will do that, and we're getting the words out too. Dave, if you want, let me know if the timing's good, but I told you Brian Edwards did something amazing for the book. I could take a minute to let you know, unless Jim wants to say something before me, or if you don't have time, we can do it some other time too.
No, we have time. I saw that Jim was in and he was having some hard time staying in the room. Jim, are you with us? Let me look here on the participant list. I don't see him by name. Sometimes there's a phone number that shows up. I guess Jim is not with us, Paul. Go ahead and give me that story about Brian.
Okay, it's a little nugget because many of you know Jeff Meek. And Jeff Meek is a fantastic guy. He interviewed us, and he got in touch. Someone got to know him who was the daughter of an FBI technician. And the FBI technician had done the spectrographic analysis of JFK's shirt, collar, and tie. Imagine. And this girl still had a handwritten copy of that analysis and gave it to Jeff Meek. Jeff Meek talked about it a little bit for JFK Revisited, the documentary by Oliver Stone. And Jeff generously sent us a copy of that document, which is an exhibit in the book. And it's the first time that copy is in the book. And basically what that letter says is, if you can imagine this, spectrographic analysis showed that there was metallic debris on the back of JFK's jacket, and also on the back of Connolly's jacket. But there was none on the collar or the tie. No debris, no metallic debris from the bullet. We asked Brian to interpret it for the book, which he did. And he says it can't be the same bullet. So, I mean, you know, you take an element. There was on a chapter proof of a front shot. And no, it actually was something called the evidentiary about CU-399. It's an amazing thing. And if you look at how the Warren Commission and the HSA kind of gloss over that, like they pay lip service to it, but you can see that it is a thorn in their side. And probably they just wanted it to slip by and nobody noticed. But that is an amazing thing. And, you know, it shows how we network and how Brian, far away, contributed that little nugget to the book.
Well, I appreciate that. I know Brian would like to hear about that too. He'll see it on the replay. But that's one of those things where it's great to have, you know, the research community, and sometimes we're not much of a community, but we really do. I know Project JFK CSI Dallas does try to make this a community of researchers that, you know, help one another or can reach out and be part of their work. I know I've done things with, William Law and with Larry Rivera just when we redid his book. Sometimes it takes a village or a community, but that's the thing. I mean, you've got a lot of researchers that, they have niche, deals that they can add to your work or to other authors' work. So I'm glad that Brian was able to be part of that. And again, the book that we're talking about is the JFK Chokeholds. And I want to encourage everybody to either go to the website, and we'll have a link on our site for the Chokeholds website, and also you can get that on Amazon in paperback, hardcover, and Kindle. Now, let me ask you a real quick question. I know I get this asked sometimes. On the Kindle edition, are people able to see the photographs? Some Kindle, depending on how formatting works, in a digital copy, sometimes you can't see photographs or documents. Have you been able to look at the Kindle edition to see if everything that's in the book is also in the Kindle edition? Because I personally like a hard copy book, or at least a softbound. I like that feel of the book in my hands, but a lot of the researchers, especially younger ones, they will go towards the Kindle or the digital copy. It's just unfortunately where books have gone to today. They're cheaper to get, and they're also easier to carry. Is it a pretty clone copy, Paul?
Matt Crumpton put it everything together for us. He was the one in charge of that. And look, I'm going to say that 99% sure that it is, because we would have heard that there was a problem. And okay. You also have a major Well, I like hard copy myself. The one advantage of the Kindle I find is the quick hyperlinking, right?
Yes.
The quick hyperlinking to, because we have really a lot of source documents, and it's often primary sources. And to go from really a footnote to a source, it's not always that evident, but to do it in Kindle. But mind you, I love hard copy. I can tell you that the sources for our book were mostly primary documents.
Okay, perfect, perfect. Well, I tell you what, I appreciate you guys coming on today. I wish we had Jimmy in the room with us, but maybe we can definitely get him back in here again, and especially for Spotlight, if we're having technical difficulties, I'll work with him if we can't get him in video, at least through a phone call. You know, like I say, from what I've heard, it's an excellent book. I like what we've talked about here today, and I encourage everybody to pick up a copy. And then when we have the Spotlight series, everybody will be getting an email. It'll be on the website at projectgfk.com in the events tab, and you aren't going to want to miss it. So again, I want to thank you guys for coming on today and sharing the great information that you have, and congratulations on getting the book written and getting it in the hands of the research community and those that maybe aren't in the research community, but they have an interest in the JFK assassination as a whole. So thank you again, Paul and Andrew. Let's see, we're gonna switch over. I see we've got Larry Snaff in the room, and you know, we missed out on the January meeting. You know, things were going on with playoffs and school starting back for me. You know, so unfortunately we didn't have a January meeting, but I think I kind of made up for that by doing 6 hours in December. So, Larry, go ahead and take it over and tell us what's new and what's been going on in your world, that affects all of us, with the case and how things are coming with that, Larry.
Good afternoon, everybody. I have a bit of a cold, so I apologize if my voice seems a little craggly. So I think the last time we spoke in December, the case was procedurally, we had a couple of motions that were pending. Contrary to accounts on Education Forum, which suggested that we had a major setback, the court denied, the government had filed a second motion to dismiss to basically throw us out of court. And the court denied that motion. So we are still very much alive in the case. We had filed our own motions that the court did not grant. We were essentially addressing issues that the court had not covered in its prior decision that we had addressed in our briefs and in our complaint. This is part of the strategy that lawyers do also. You have to create a record and make sure that all the issues have been engaged. So although those motions were denied, we're in a good position now. We did also try to advise the court why the transparency plans should be enjoined from being used, because they didn't comply with the JFK Act, but the court still has its own opinion of the way the JFK Act works, and the court denied that. So basically now we're past the motion stage. We're now going to the next phase of the case. I can't really go into details about what we're going to do next because we are in discussions with our client. We have a number of things we can do, but normally, you know, in a normal case, you go to discovery and then you go to trial. So I can talk about the case where we are, but we haven't decided yet exactly what we're doing. We're pretty close, and we'll probably have some information next month or so. Patrick, is there anything else that we could talk about in terms of?
Well, just from an overall perspective, our lawsuit says that under the JFK Act, the public, and in particular these plaintiffs, are entitled to access declassified documents. Now, the act itself is much more powerful than FOIA, and it was designed as part of our contention that it is a remedial act passed by Congress, which may sound incredible today, but it was unanimously passed by Congress and also signed by a president who I understand is the only CIA director to ever become president, of course, George Bush Sr., and that the idea of turning it over, that is the discretionary aspects of the act's execution, back to the executive branch, which was the problem in the first place, is illogical. It doesn't make sense under the act. And that we have a lot to talk about in the future as far as the application of the act, but also we're going to be able to, I think, access documents that for persons, especially who are experts in particular areas, they'll find it most useful. And as the years go by, the act will be more effectively applied. And I'm fairly confident in that. Thank you.
Yeah. And so where we are now is that, you know, the court has preserved our claims for missing, destroyed, and removed records. And so that's what's on the table right now. We had obviously had broader claims to require additional searches. The court felt the JFK Act did not authorize that at this point in time. We disagree with that, and we may revisit that issue at another time. But right now we're focusing on the missing, destroyed, and removed records. If any of you, we are developing our list. If any of you have particular records that you feel were removed, destroyed, or are missing from the JFK collection, Bill, feel free to let us know, and we will include that, you know, in our next iteration. We have a couple other things going on. Just in the early stages, we are pursuing, we're working on a new JFK Act, amending the current JFK Act. We have I don't mean Mary Farrell, but there's a sort of a spin out of this. We do have someone that's helping us with Congress. And so we're doing several parallel things at the same time. We have another thing that I can't talk about yet, but could actually result in maybe, I'll just say that, Bill Simpich and I back in 2018, I think it was, offered to bring a real life court of inquiry petition in Texas to expunge Oswald's arrest. We didn't have interest by the family at that point in time. We think we have a better chance now. So we might actually, we're thinking about how we can do this, but there is actually a real life, there is a mechanism in court in Texas. It's sort of, think about like the Innocence Project. While the law is stylized to basically expunge convictions, the law does not appear to contemplate a defendant being killed in police custody. And for those of you who might be aware, Bill Simpich and I did a mock court of inquiry proceeding in 2019 at the Kappa event, where John Orr served as the prosecutor before a real Texas judge. So we think we have a path to bring a real life action, and we're exploring the jurisdictional requirements, including whether we need to have an actual family member and this conviction issue. I think, based on our preliminary research, I think we have all the bases covered, but we're still going to work on that. That's something that obviously is going to take a little time, since we're also working on the JFK, on the Mary Farrell case. But that's something we have a number of legal things we're working on. So if anyone wants to talk about I can talk about the case as to what the holdings were, what the motions were, but I can't really talk about the next steps because we haven't actually, our client hasn't decided yet, and we're having conversations with our client. So there are a lot of tools and options on the table. I'm just not in a position yet to talk about them, but I can talk backwards about what the judge held, and any questions you have about the case up to this point.
Well, thank you, Larry. I know that obviously, you know, you can't give away strategy, and you also have to keep things under wrap until you file briefs. So that's totally understandable. I want to appreciate you for giving us the heads up on that. And if anybody would like to ask questions for Larry that he can't answer, then please, you know, unmute and ask away.
Yeah, I want to – this was part of my 60th anniversary presentation, but I can't think of a more important document than Lee Oswald's passport, the one that he renewed on 25 June 1963, which had been suppressed. And as I tracked it down to the FBI with a FOIA request, they advised me that this had been sent on to the National Archives. Okay, now, at what you see up here in the background is the copy of the passport that I found at the North Texas University repository, where it had been just sitting there for years and years, and where clearly it says that with that passport, D-092526, you could not go to Cuba under any pretext or any way, okay? So, given that we now know that the passport existed because we have reasonable facsimiles of it, I can't think of a more important document that needs to be tracked down with the National Archives.
So, Larry, do you know whether the review board, A, tried to find it, and B, what the outcome was?
No, not at all. And why is this important? Because what the information on the passport shoots down anything that you would want to try to invent on Mexico City. All right. And we know by the visa application that that's the passport that they attempted to use in an exercise which would have been of entire futility because you could not travel to Cuba on a U.S. passport with the rubber stamp that was stamped right on there. You know, it's right behind my head here. Okay. And it stopped when I approached the FBI last year. Okay, so that's where we stand on that. It needs to be taken further since now we have.
Let me ask it because there are legal definitions of removed, missing, and destroyed.
Of course. Okay? And I was going to address that.
Do you know if the review board attempted to look to obtain this?
Not at all, because we never had evidence that the passport existed. It was never documented by the Warren Commission. All we knew at the time was the passport number, but also with buried with the passport images, I also found the receipt by the FBI signed by Warren DeBrew on that next Tuesday, where he received not only that passport, but the original one that Lee Oswald used to go to Russia. Now, they were not found at Ruth Payne's garage. Okay, they were found at the rooming house at 1025 North Beckley. Okay, so the chain of evidence, as DeBrew receives it, we have that receipt, and it's signed by DeBrew. And then from there, I went to the FBI. The FBI said, okay, look, if we had it, they don't even admit that they had it. If we had it, it's with the National Archives now. And that's where we stand on the passport.
Okay, so I just want to circle back. So if you can, in an email, tell me what is in the collection with respect to this issue, right? Whether we have the ARB asking for it and then being given an answer saying we can't find it, or the ARB not. I just need to kind of know what happened during the time of the life of the ARB. Now, to let others, there's another issue that we have somebody that's actually been going to the Clinton Library. There's 10 boxes of ARB records in the Clinton Library that are not online. And so I have someone going there taking images of the documents. There's a bunch that relate to post-ARB time. There's emails with the NSC and the Clinton White House after the ARB went out of business. So we are, and this is a process. I may end up flying down there to expedite the process, but you have to ask for the record, you know, the boxes, they take them out, and it's a cumbersome process. So, but we are also looking to see what may be in the ARB files at the Clinton Library that might not be online that could be helping us in our case as well. But Larry, just let me know what, you know, kind of find out what the ARB did and where it stopped.
There is no information whatsoever on that. Nothing. Zero.
Okay.
But
I can tell you right now, zero.
Okay.
Let me interject here real quick, Larry. I know that you sent me the copy that I believe that was it DOJ or was it FBI that talks about the passport. Larry, have you seen this document that Larry's got?
I don't know. I mean, I've been so buried in the motion practice, I honestly haven't been focusing, having that time to focus on the paper trail that Larry's been working on.
Well, yeah. Definitely you two need to get together. Larry, please send the information to Larry. Larry and Larry need to get to together. Share with what you've got, Mr. Rivera, and that way Mr. Snap there can have the paper trail. It was very interesting to me to learn about this when Larry told me about it, and he sent me the document.
I published it on my blog. They're up on my blog also.
Okay, well, if you can, I know with time constraints and stuff, especially as Larry, as busy as he is with the filings, please email that directly to him, and then that I'd like to know more about this. I'm sure everybody else.
A reason for the suppression, ladies and gentlemen. Here, there is a reason for this to have been suppressed. Okay, and this is something that I cannot stress how important this is, because the entire Mexico City scenario is a house of cards that's been held up by the lack of this document. It doesn't matter. We have it right here. You know, here's a very, very good, you know, I found the thumbnails, the sepia thumbnails there, and then we were able to process them digitally, and we have perfect copies of all the, most of the pages of the other thing that the pages lacked were the actual visa. You know, in a passport, you get the visa pages where you get stamped and everything. That's missing. It doesn't matter, because we have the first five pages. And in the first five pages is the rubber stamp where you cannot go to Cuba on this passport, period.
So I just want to make a note to Bob in the chat that we are aware that we're aware of that procedure. We're past that procedure now in terms of filing a petition of missing records. We're aware of the records that are missing. We're pursuing those records in the next phase of the litigation. But if anyone, what I'm asking for is if people are aware of, like Larry just talked about, the passport, you know, but there are other things that you are aware of that are, for example, we all know about the Heath memo by now. The Heath memo, Donald Heath wrote that memo in 1977, sent it off to the HSCA. About his investigation that he was ordered to do in Miami over the weekend of the assassination, exploring whether any exiles or Cubans could have been involved in the assassination. The FBI, the CIA always denied they had done that sort of investigation. He reports in his memo that where these records, the reports that were issued, could have been located, and he reports that he saw these records in a Mr. McLean's office in 1973. What happened to them? So, and actually, Doug Horn, I am probably going to need to talk to you about the internal R process. Other words, like, who do I have to talk to about who within the ARB would have been following up on the Heath memo? I think it probably was Joe Freeman, but I'm not sure. But if we could talk offline about what individuals within the ARB might be the persons that we need to follow up on this next phase of the litigation, that would be helpful.
Larry?
Yeah.
Paul Blow here.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, how are you doing? I think there's probably a lot that should be on the Fair Play for Cuba committee. And then let me explain myself. There's so much correspondence that they were intercepting.
Right.
And there are so many similar cases before the JFK, the assassination in Dallas, where you had people like Policarpo Lopez, Von Marlowe, Richard Case Miguel, that have documented relations with the Fair Play for Cuba committee. And I just feel that there's so little that has been provided. Maybe it's a 301 file. I don't know, because 301 is more for organizations of interest. But I think there's a Klondike of information relating to the Fair Play. I have some. I have some on how they were penetrated. And that's the other thing. They were so penetrated by so many informants. But where's the information on them? I don't know how they see that, but if ever you can make a dent there, boy, I'm sure we'd find out a lot of stuff.
So at this phase of the litigation, and Patrick, let me know if I'm wrong, is that we can't go on fishing expeditions. We have to kind of know that there are records, were records that were removed, missing, or destroyed, right? If we don't have evidence that the record existed, that would be for a different phase of the litigation. But right now, it's records that we know are missing, destroyed, or removed. Is that right? Patrick?
Yeah, it has to be reasonably calculated to lead to discovery of admissible evidence. So with regard to Mr. Rivera's comments, I mean, that he has the, I assume he has a copy of the debris receipt, which is, that's a documentation. So we could refer to that as lost or destroyed. Another example, and this is, I'm deliberately going a little further on the spectrum with this, is we know that Oswald dropped a note off at FBI headquarters, within approximately 10 days or so prior to the shooting. And so, to me, that's a powerful statement to the effect that it's strong evidence that Oswald was not planning to shoot JFK at that time. Because why would he uncover himself in that fashion?
But, Paul, so what I'm asking about is, like, Paul is making references to Fair Play. We don't, unless the ARB has a paper trail that stopped or what they've tried to look for, in this phase of the litigation, like if we have if you have some signs of these connections, then let us know and we can try to evaluate. But if it's just like we think they should exist, but we don't have any evidence, that's a separate question for a different part of the litigation. Right now we're looking for the records. There are records that we know existed, and they were either missing, removed, or destroyed.
That's right. Like the Oswald note or the passport.
Okay. So what I'll send you, Larry, is proof. Well, I think the proof is that what I can show is that they were extremely investigated. They were investigated nonstop. So I'll send you proof that the FBI, had documents and the go-ahead to investigate the Fair Play for Cuba committee. What that means is there are documents that have to have existed, but without necessarily having been identified singularly. So see what we can do with that.
One of the other things we need to do, the last time that we got together, David, I gave a list at the end of recommendations how to deal with FOIA requests, and also it might be that what the next step would be is for you to specifically file a petition with the FBI for these records, and then when they come back and say we can't find them, that is then the predicate for us to add them to our list. That might be something. So we are actually, as part of this process, the way the NARA handles requests is at best ad hoc. Say that. And there should be a procedure in place to be consistent with the spirit and the letter of the law of the JFK Act. When anybody approaches NARA with a request, what they're doing now is, we can't find it, go use FOIA. That's not what they should be doing in the JFK Act. The next step should be NARA contacts the agency and says, where are these records? And
yeah, this, I would say this passing the buck shit seems to, you know, get in the way of actually getting the information. If somebody is supposed to actually, you know, take the ball and lead with it, then they shouldn't be going and going, well, you go here, you go there. They, like you just said, I mean, NARA needs to do their job of you know, finding.
I would say the statute, the way we read the statute is that when they receive this request, they're supposed to check the collection. Okay, they check their collection and they come back and their normal response is, except for one time with Bill Kelly, when somehow one of the Secret Service agents had some stuff at home. But most of the time they say, we can't find it in the collection, please use FOIA. Now, that in itself violates the act because Congress said FOIA does not work for this issue. They should be doing the next step, which is then go to the agency. The agency comes back with a response. At that point, let's say the agent says, we can't find it. At that point, then the researcher has a right to appeal to the next level. And then when that decision is made, then now we have a final action that we can now pursue. So, but they're shortcutting that. They're throwing everything in the FOIA when Congress said FOIA doesn't work.
So is there checks and balances kind of askewed, Larry?
Yeah, they're not. It's not checks and balances. They're viewing assassination records through the lens of the typical way that records are handled. And Congress said that this is, you can't do it this way. We have a memo from 1999 from the CIA called the Lessons Learned Memo, where it goes into great detail as to how the JFK Records Act changed the way that they look at historic records in this area. So we're going to file a petition with NARA to change their rules. Their existing regulations are very passive. They sit back and wait for records to come to them, and they provide assistance.
I have a question.
Yes.
Who is the oversight? I apologize for not turning my screen on. It's upside down for some reason. But who is the oversight, the congressional oversight to NARA, that makes them do what they're supposed to do? Who sets their policies? Is there an oversight?
Yes, there's an oversight committee. We tried when Carol Maloney was the chair of that committee, and she's was my representative. I had extensive outreach with the committee. Now, this is, David, this goes to your separation of powers issue, because when you have a Democratic president, a Democratic House at the time is not going to try to – will not hold a hearing to examine if the president is complying with the law. I mean, I went all the way up the food chain, and I basically said – we will work in behind the scenes with the White House, but we're not going to hold a hearing and embarrass the president.
Okay.
The founding fathers created separate branches, thinking they would jealously guard their prerogatives. You would think Congress would want to make sure that the law it passed is being enforced. Now, we have a Republican House. We tried to reach out to the current chair of the House Oversight Committee, but they have other things that they're trying to pursue with Hunter Biden and stuff instead of focusing on So, the answer to your question is normally Congress, if it was functioning properly, would be monitoring the compliance with the JFK Act, but they're not doing it. We asked, I had a petition, a letter signed by a whole bunch of open interest, open government types, and they just poo-pooed it.
The reason I asked that question specifically is because before Dad died in 2014, he had me approach Congressman Hanserling because he had lost his handler, his hammer. And Hanserling had me contact the Dallas FBI office. Dad lived in Dallas. When they disbanded after Dallas, Dad was still CIA and ONI and another couple of alphabet soups off the books. And he said they moved everybody out. He stayed because his family had been there. And so I did as Dad instructed, went to Dallas FBI. They would not help me or the congressman. He had to go all the way back to Washington to the address I gave him that was not one of the three branches. It was not one of the agencies. And the physical location to get someone to come down and talk to Dad. He knew his code name. You mentioned about the note that Oswald had written 10 days before It was about the same time frame Dad said they found out what the mission really was, because he said Lee was on his team, that and Owen and I, that Dad went to my grandfather, his dad, and rewrote his will. I found the will in the cellar, dated October 31st. That one person on Dad's team committed suicide. Another one went crazy. Dad asked to get out, and they said no, or you're dead, your whole family's dead. So my problem is, I'm not here to convince you guys of my dad's story. I just want to share information. I'm stonewalled and cannot get Dad's 201 file. And if we get it, if we get the refusal where they say they can't find it, I've got documents proving it. One's on my screen, the top secret. I found stuff related to Italy and being Dallas by November. Dad was in World War II with JFK. He was involved before, during, after. Carried plans for Lowfield. I have his statements. I have his audio. I can't get any documents from the agency. They've been stonewalling me.
Procedurally, you filed a request with whom?
First the CIA. FBI was denied. CIA, I have not heard back.
Was it denied in writing?
No. When I contacted Naval Intelligence, they said anything your dad possibly has is not of interest to me. I said, you don't understand what he's involved in. So in November, before I spoke in Dallas, Mom, 87, pulled out another truck, and I found his NATO documents where he had the cosmic clearance. But when it was the Photo Interpretation Center, and Eisenhower changed the Photo Interpretation Center to NPEC 2 days before Kennedy was sworn in to make it under the control of CIA.
Okay,
I have the documentation.
Procedurally, if you want to be able to move forward legally, what you need to do is put requests in writing to these agencies for your father's records. That's what you're trying to get, right?
Right.
Okay.
And may I interrupt real quickly? I believe the first place to start would be the NPRC in St. Louis.
Let me just procedurally, you file these requests for your father's records in writing and have them to provide you with a response back. Depending on which agency it is, you might have a chance then to go to an administrative appeal, which you don't have to pay for,
okay,
in order to reconsider that decision. Then
I need someone to mentor me on the steps of this process,
okay,
someone to step up and help me,
yeah,
along the way.
Send me an email.
Because when Dad tried, St. Louis tried to give him some baloney about those with the sets of records burned, and I went over to Fort Worth and found some. I don't believe it for one second. And then on the second hand, I have documents they don't have.
Now, by the way, so the workaround, there is – NARA has a special group for veterans records. Now, that's principally to help people get their benefits. So you could try that as well as a workaround. I don't think it's going to get you where you want. But
no, he was scared to go to the VA because they wanted to know about his benefits. He wouldn't talk about it. And the thing about this is when Admiral Zumwalt told me to keep working on Dad's book before Bud died, and he knew about Dad's relationship with Omar Bradley, who was one of the first directors of the CIA up there with the others. And they were friends. I got pictures of Dad with him. So what? A lot of pictures can exist. The issue is when he was with Admiral Byrd, Admiral Byrd needed some documents to get to Antarctica in 1955. Dad went to the same location I gave Jeb and got the Admiral the documents in 30 minutes that he would have had to wait for 3 months from Congress. There's some kind of connection he had to get things that even the vice admirals couldn't get. And I can't get any documentation on his history. His DD-214 was wiped clean once he got this top secret clearance you see on my screen.
Here's what you should do, because we don't want to have another six-hour phone call.
Right.
So what you send me an email, larry@schnatzlaw.com. Itemize the things you have asked for and the way you've asked for them, okay?
Okay.
And then we could figure out what the procedure should be, so you at least create a trail so you're in a position to do something legally at some point.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Now, one other thing, Jeff Morley and I, as part of this congressional outreach, we are, every Thursday night we have a podcast, and we ask people to give us the names of their representatives, because we are developing a form letter for everyone to send to their representative asking them to essentially either conduct oversight or we want to amend the whole hearings on amending the law. So again, anyone here, we have 52 people here. I'm sure there's a lot of overlap, but we probably have at least 24 people that have different representatives. Please send to Dave the names of your representatives and your district, if you know that, but the names are important first. And then, Dave, you send them to me, and we'll add them to the collection. We're probably at some, you know, there's 438 representatives. If we can get 100 or something, you know, we then have kind of a nucleus enough to move something. You know, we want, you know, the idea is then we would then send each of you a form letter, which you could then, you know, you could make some edits around the edges to make it in your the way you speak. But we want each representative to get a letter from a constituent saying, please, we have to have a new JFK Act. And we actually have a draft of a bill that we're working with a lobbyist and we're going to submit it to, we've identified someone we think might be the right person to start the ball rolling. The Justice for Kennedy Act got nowhere, the one that Assemblyman Congressman Schweikert introduced. It got no co-sponsors. I'm not even sure he even tried to get a sponsor. So we're not sure if this was sort of like a public relations thing or whether one constituent asked him to do it. There's no evidence that he has been pursuing trying to get people to support this bill. So we don't think that while that bill has some merits to it, we don't think it's going to be the basis for real action. So before you leave today, send either put it in, Dave, you can see things in the chat, right? They're saved?
Yeah, they'll be in the chat log, and then the chat log and also the chat log and also the replay will be up on YouTube and on our website by tomorrow. So again, definitely what Larry's asking for, I mean, it's a few minutes of your time, but in the broader scale and larger scale, this is what we need to do. So you can either send them to projectjfk@yahoo.com, or you can also send them to Larry Snaff's email. And if you miss Larry Snaff's email, you can always go on to the blog section on projectjfk@yahoo.com, and you can send an email to him from his section. So we've talked about this in the past. And I like how, you know, you guys are coming up with the form letter. You know, not all of us, I'm definitely not in the legal field. I try to keep my ass out on the good side of things, but I know enough to get me in trouble. But that's the reason why, like you and Bill Simpage and Patrick McCarthy coming on, I mean, a little light bulb went off my head. Maybe we need to make a short video describing this to people to, you know how they're supposed to do the right way to get the response. It may not be such a bad idea, Larry.
Yeah, I mean, because honestly, one of the problems we have is people say, well, I contacted NARA and I couldn't get a response, but they did it by phone, for example, right? Or they didn't keep the email. We really got to start documenting because we have a couple of documented incidents how NARA handled records requests. But most people didn't keep, we have to let people know you got to create a paper trail. And you got to keep records. And this is, I think that might be a helpful thing to do a video. How do you file a request? And what are your rights afterwards? And we want to make sure that anytime somebody asks NARA for JFK records, that this is a documented request so we can show the court how NARA is handling this and, in our opinion, handling it illegally or improperly. So just to step back. We have a number of parallel things we're doing here. We have the lawsuit. We're going to be trying to deal with the congressionally. So for those of you, if you want to do something, the way you could help is give us the name of your representative. We will then give you back a letter. This is probably going to be sometime in the fall or the summer, where we will then give you the letter, and then you will then put it in your own words, or you can just sign it. It's up to you. You know, you may want to. We don't use contractions, for example, in our letters. Maybe you want to use a does it instead of does not, right? Things like that. But you can put it in your own voice, and then send it to your representative.
So, yeah, and I was going to say, Mary Ann put her her person in the chat log. If you're going to put that in there, be sure to include your email in your response. That way, Larry can send you out the form and the document. It looks like Mary's is Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, Louisiana 4.
Well,
so
that's a good start, right?
You know,
so
that,
anyway, just this is a process. We're accumulating names now. So if you don't hear from us, you know, a week or two, it's not we didn't hear it. We're accumulating names. We want to, when we get to a certain critical mass, if we get to a certain critical mass, then we could push the button that I viewed as acupuncture buttons, right? One is a lawsuit, one is the Congress. If we get to a critical mass, then we could start pushing that button. So it's going to take a few months to get the critical mass. So, but please, probably easier, David, if they put it in for now, if they put it in the chat, and then you could just forward it to me.
Yeah.
If you don't know the name of your representative right now, today, look it up and then email us.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I tell you what, Larry, after we get offline here in the next week, I'll reach out to you, and maybe we can work on putting a short video together, because there's nothing more frustrating than when you reach out to an organization or a department and you're trying to get a response, but if you aren't doing it the correct way or the way that, you know, they want you to do it and you're not creating that paper trail, then you're basically, you know, tits up on the fact that you're not going to get a response.
Or, David, you might reach someone like Bill Kelly got lucky and met someone when he contacted NARA, who not only knew what the drill was, but was motivated to do something. You might get someone that doesn't know what to do, and then you don't know what to do. So actually, you could put up the slide that I had at the end of our last show, our last podcast. It was a one-page PowerPoint slide, which laid out how you file a FOIA request and what your rights are. We could put that up for now.
I don't have that readily available.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
Okay, send it to me, and then I can pop it up there. And that's another good thing about this. I know some people have been asking in the chat, you know, we're having great information. If they're coming in late or they're having issues with a connection. Yes, the replays to our Zoom meeting here, they are posted on the events tab on our projectjfk.com website. And then also it's on the YouTube channel. And for those of you that, you know, happen to catch a video off the website, click the little YouTube icon. It'll take you right to our site and hit that subscribe button. So when new videos come out, you'll know, you'll be one of the first people to know. We've got a decent subscriber base. I think we're close to 500, which, you know, it's a drop in the bucket to some websites, or some channels, but, in this niche market of, researchers, that's a considerable amount. That's people that are wanting to get this information. So definitely hit the subscribe button. Check out the website each time. You know, things get updated on there semi-regularly. It depends on how much time is available to do, you know, some housekeeping on it. And definitely anything that Larry's got. I know we haven't posted a lot in Larry's blog section. Larry, I want to work with you on that, get some more information out there. And I think an idea of putting up a, you know, it could be even a 10 to 15 minute video of how to, we go to the internet for everything else, whether it's, you know, fixing a car or a piece of, you know, electronics, we need a video out there, because, I mean, quite frankly, I haven't come across one yet, of how to do something the right way. And I definitely trust Larry and Patrick and Bill Snippage.
I just wanted, there's a point, there's a chat now in the, Bob was suggesting he has a FOIA template. I want to say this again. FOIA is a waste of time for JFK assassination records because of the exemptions. That's why Congress chose the JFK Act. So when you're contacting NARA, you are making a request under the JFK Records Act, not under FOIA, because there are a ton of exemptions of FOIA. The FBI, for example, just is one, has an enforcement. Even though there's no current enforcement going on in the JFK Act, law enforcement, they use that law enforcement exemption not to disclose records. So FOIA is a waste of time. Again, I want to make sure that people are asking for the records in the right way, and they're documenting their requests, and they're documenting their responses back. So, David, we'll do that offline.
I appreciate that, Larry. Yeah, there's always a right way to do things, and there's several hundreds or thousands of ways to do it the wrong way. But if we wanted to have this move forward and not be a waste of the wheels just spinning and we're not going anywhere, definitely take heed of what Larry said and also Patrick. And then, you know, let's move the right direction to get this to get the information that that we need as a community and as individual researchers. So, Larry, I want to thank you and Patrick for your time. And definitely, you know, reach out with your representatives, whether it's by email to me or Larry.
Give us their names first. We will then give you a letter that you can reach out to them. So you make sure
right.
You do the right thing.
Again, another point, you know, doing it the right way to know, you know, I love the fact that you guys have created a form letter. You know, like say you're involved in this on a daily basis and know the law. A lot of us are laymen and we don't. So again, it's asking it's asking it in the correct way. So, well, we're looking at the hour and a half, moment. So I'm going to take a quick break for station identification. And that's what they say when you're listening to the baseball game. This is Project JFK CSI Dallas. I am your host, David Knight, along with Brian Edwards and Casey Quinlan. I want to thank everybody for coming out today. You know, 50 plus people in the room, that's always better than, you know, 20. But, hey, I'll have a meeting with one person. But it's always better to have more people because we can share the information. The replays are great. You can always find those on ProjectJFK.com in the events section. And along with the video, if you scroll past the video section, you will see the chat logs. You can download those as a text document. And sometimes I know Larry was putting in a lot of links. The links work great when you're live, but they don't work great because they're not links in the chat log in the text document. But what you can do is highlight that link that is posted in the chat log, and you can right click on it and it will take you directly to that link, or you can copy and paste it into your browser window, whichever browser you're using. So again, you know, we're the, I heard that term the other day in a court setting, a horde, not a horde, but a horde of information. Larry's laughing. He knows what I'm talking about. But yeah, we're a horde of information and we want to share it. That's the whole point of why we're doing this. And I want to thank everybody that's in attendance today. Everybody that's watching us on Zoom and the replays. If you're not, whether you're in person, you're not in person. You know, this is a sharing of ideas. This is why we come together and this is why we do this. We are not waiting. You know, we waited 60 years for the damn truth. You know, we're tired of waiting. But if we don't ask the questions, if we don't, you know, make the records, records requests, the bad part of it is we're just spinning our wheels. The government's not going to do this for us. If they were going to do it, they would have done it 60 years ago. They put out their, you know, their fairy tale of this is what took place and swallow it. With a spoonful of sugar and, you know, hope the medicine goes down. Well, the bullshit doesn't go down. We're still choking that down and passing it back up. Pardon my descriptive way of saying it, but, you know, we're tired of the bullshit. We want the answers. And that's why we're here doing what we're doing. Larry, you got your hand up?
Yeah. One more thing. Bobby Jr. has a petition for releasing the records. So if you haven't signed that yet, please do so. I don't know. I think he's got several thousand name people signed it already. But just another, we're trying multiple parallel paths to get to the center, right? So that's another thing to do. So if I think you can go on to the website and sign the petition without having to give him money if you're concerned about that. But that petition.
I know I don't get political. I don't choose sides. You know, I leave that for everybody's own way. But I noticed that one of the Super Bowl ads this year that I really enjoyed was actually, and I know it maybe pissed some people off, especially in the Kennedy family, but I enjoyed seeing Bobby Jr.'s reflection back on JFK's ad from back in the '60s. I wasn't upset about that at all. Actually, I think more ads like that should be it's better than the mudslinging back and forth and, you know, so-and-so did this and so-and-so did that. So again, I've noticed when I looked at the information the other day, you know, 27% recognize as Republican, 27% represent as Democrat, and 42% represent as independent. You know, Bobby was a Democrat at one time and now he's run as independent. So you got to make up your own mind and just think, you know, there's a lot of people say, well, especially I run across, some younger people. I'm around them, you know, 3 days a week in person at the college. You know, they may not want to, vote because they don't think that their, vote counts. It does count, you know, and if you don't vote.
I'm just saying, I posted on my Facebook page, I'll just say this once. And, since we're talking about this issue, is that Bill and I have spent probably over 400 hours fighting this case. And I am so appalled by the positions that the Department of Justice has taken and the failure of the president to do the right thing that I've urged people that Biden have to pay a price for doing what he did. And I would urge people on if this is really important to you, then the message would be to send him a note saying, I can't vote for you unless you release those records. You know, but people have other things that maybe are more important to them in their lives. But for me, having been in the trenches, I am so offended by the way this administration, they could have been so many ways that they could have chosen a different path. And Bill and I wouldn't have had to spend 400 hours, and we speak weekly to, you know, on, and Patrick helps us. We speak weekly on strategy. I mean, the amount of time we're spending on this, it's so unnecessary. And this administration could have taken a very different approach and they failed to do that. On this issue alone is why I am opposed to Biden, but I'll leave it up to you guys as to what your most important issues are. But to me, voting for him would be rewarding his actions.
And Larry, why do you think he took that position?
Because he was told, I'll just say the NSC told him to sign this document. Trump, he did it with Trump too. I'm not saying, but I want to be clear. Trump also succumbed to the National Security Council. In fact, if any of you have heard that video of Judge Napolitano saying that when he asked Judge President Trump, why didn't you release the records? And President Trump tells him, if you saw what I saw, you would have done the same thing. That is incorrect. Because when he was President Biden, President Trump, I sued to get the records involving the communications with President Trump's postponements. The president never saw any records. When he was going out on Twitter and saying, I'm going to release the records, there was already version 12 of a postponement order. These presidents, the NSC runs national security. They tell the president what they can or cannot do. No president, most presidents are afraid to go against the CIA because if God forbid something, they don't want to have a 9/11 happen, right? So the NSC says you can't disclose this because it's going to undermine our operations and sources and methods, he's going to say, okay. He's not going to question, well, this is 60 years old. Are you telling me you're still using sources and methods? You know, they just don't go to that level. The White House counsel tells the president that they spoke to the NSC and he should sign this order. That's what happened.
That's not how our country was founded. That's not – the NSC is not constitutionally founded as the fourth branch of our military. I mean, our government.
I have learned through my litigation in this case how the reality is. So I don't think the president knows about anything in those records. I don't think he had any curiosity to find out. I don't think Trump did. You know, the only one that may have had some interest would have been Clinton, and even he, you know, he allowed a lot of postponements. So my personal, I'm not voting for him because of my experience in this case. I'm not telling you what to do, but I don't want to reward him. I mean, Bill and I could have been working on something else long ago, and they could have settled this case. They have taken taken the most aggressive position that they ever could have taken. They basically, the way the arguments that the government has advanced in this litigation essentially eviscerates the JFK Act. They are rewriting the act, and the judge went along with those arguments when they threw out the president from the case. So this is egregious what they've done, and the Senate won't do anything because the Senate is a Democratic really run, and the House won't do it because the House is focused on other things. So,
well, I want to throw this out there, Larry. I'll finish my last comment that I had. Your voice does count. Your vote does count. And if you're not using it, then, you know, remember the people that get elected, the reason why they're getting elected is we're putting them in there, you know, or a small group, not the entire population, put them in there because they decide they don't want to vote. So when it comes that time in November, get out there and vote and pick the right candidate, whoever that may be, whatever your opinion is, whatever your thought is, it's your vote. You have to cast it. So, you know, I'm not going to stand on a soapbox on it, but remember, you know, the people that get in there are the ones that are representing us. So,
well, no, they're not really representing us anymore. That's the problem.
That's the problem. So if
right,
you want them
interests, and I mean, I can't tell you the level of frustration looking at the transparency plans, seeing that they don't comply with the act because they have conditions in there that don't comply with the act, that they postpone records beyond. Remember, Congress passed the act because their records were going to be held till 2029. The transparency plans, the earliest the records will be released at the 2040s. And any records that involve NATO countries, unless President Trump comes in and abolishes NATO, that any records that are involving NATO countries, unless those countries allow those records to be released, they will be are forever postponed. To see, they are preventing us from understanding what happened in our country because they're afraid of us to know. This is like Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men saying, you know, you can't take the truth. Anyway, okay.
Joe's got his hand up. Joe, go ahead.
All right. They're making the argument to the President of the United States that the JFK Act is an unconstitutional limit on presidential authority over records such as these, to the president's ability to classify them in the first place and to declassify and classify them. That's in the Curtis Gannon memo when he was with the Office of Legal Counsel under Trump. And that has been, instead of reversed, seems to have been solidified under Joe Biden. But the argument is being made to them that it's a infringement on presidential power. So you have to deal with that hurdle first. That has nothing to do with the Kennedy assassination, whether you think it's a lone nut or a conspiracy. As they're not even going anywhere near anything involved with the issues of the case or the records. So if people think, you know, a huge conspiracy is going on. Yeah, maybe, but I mean, an ideological argument is being made here, first and foremost. It's false, but that's what's going on at the presidential level.
Right.
And both
Joe's
Trump
right.
And both Biden have bought into it.
Right. Joe is right in the sense that what they've resurrected is when President Bush signed the JFK law into law, he had a signing statement. And in that
right.
statement, he said that he felt that this act illegally, unconstitutionally infringed on his rights as commander in chief. The Gannon memo, as Joe said, brought that, basically took that presidential signing statement and now made it an official position of the Department of Justice.
That Curtis Gannon memo is what eviscerated the JFK Act.
That was done in September of 2017. Now, that memo, you have to understand how this works. He was asked to write that memo with that conclusion.
Yes.
Right? So
that memo was online. You can look it up, folks.
Yeah. Yes.
Curtis Gannon. He
yes.
is currently now the Solicitor General the attorney who argues before the United States Supreme Court.
Right, he's one of the solicitor generals.
Yeah.
So he was asked to write. So this is not something where.
So he's still in government. He's still in high power official.
Not rewarded. So the way this works is the White House wants a policy to be implemented, and then the Department of Justice Office of Legal Counsel then writes a memo supporting that policy. It's not like them asking their lawyer, can I do this? They wanted a specific outcome. And so the NSC was, this was written in September. The first memos for postponement started circulating the end of August. So they were trying to get legal support for this position. So Curtis Gannon was tasked. And because who he is, he's a very well-respected attorney. It was a brilliant memo. And this court has adopted almost word for word this distinction between sections 5 and 6. And it's a parsing of the statute that, as Patrick said, it's supposed to be a remedial statute, which is broadly interpreted to accommodate and effectuate the intent of Congress. And this is about the power of the presidency and the view that the president should have unfettered right in the area of national security. And this has been rejected on some accounts in some cases in the past, but this is Joe is right that this is the underlying principle. And when I have joked with Patrick and Bill that we may have stumbled on a constitutional case, you know, now Congress has the power under the Constitution to write laws, and they have imposed constraints on the president, and those constraints have been ignored by the court. So, but Joseph's joke, it's not that, you're right, Joe, at one level, it's not because they're trying, you can't say that they're doing this purely.
Because they know about the records and they know about the case.
Right.
They have to stop this. That's not what's going on.
Right. So, like, the first thing they wanted to do was get the president out of the case. That was the major focus of them. And honestly, if we hadn't named, you know, I don't know. But they were focused on, they don't want the president's power to be impugned in any way. And the problem is, the more the president's power gets expanded, then when you get a bad president in office, he can do bad things. So I don't want to get into a whole theory about constitutional law, but Joe's right that at some level this is a constitutional argument, but we're saying Congress was clear in the statute and that they have the power to rein in the president, even in his capacity as commander-in-chief, and that these records really don't pertain to national security anymore because they're so old. But anyway.
All right, guys. Well, hey, I tell you what, we're going to wrap this section up. I have something special here. For our next section, and this is completely unplanned, but I'm glad it's happening. I want to welcome to the group here. This is the first time we've had this individual with us. They're kind of the three of them in the picture there. We have Brian Edwards, we have Gary Shaw, and I want to introduce and say a special thank you to Ricky White for joining us today. So guys, please take it away. And I know we don't have the round of applause, but believe me, we're all clapping. So thank you for joining us. Project JFK on the road down in Texas today, joining us, you know, via Zoom. So guys, take it over.
Thanks, David. Just want to let everybody know that we're in Cleburne, Texas, and we've got 300 books. We just got through signing. So the new book about the Roscoe White story is complete, and it's in our hand. And if you ordered it, we are packing it up as the day ends. So autographing all copies. So you'll get yours if you ordered one through the Fennell Unlimited. If not, I encourage you to do that. Or we encourage you to do that. But Ricky is with us. And so if anybody has any questions for Rick, real quick ones, I'm sure he'll be glad to answer. But if you want to say something to everybody.
Hey, thank you all very much, man. I really do. It's been a long time coming. And I can't thank these guys here any more than not possibly Kid. It would never happen if it wasn't for Gary Shaw or Brian. You know, that's what I can say.
Well, we definitely want to thank all three of you for joining us today. I know I've been reading the book, and I got to say, if you haven't ordered a copy of it, you definitely need to get a copy for your collection. I know I talked about it at the beginning of the show. I didn't know you guys were going to be on with us today. Tell me, let me ask you, Ricky, I mean, going through this, this process of writing the book and, you know, and telling the story, how I know we had you in Dallas for the, for the panel discussion, which was, you could have heard a pin drop in that room. I know that, everybody that was in attendance, I was really happy with the outpouring of, the attendees that, listened to what your story was, but there's some people that, wasn't there in Dallas or wasn't on Zoom. The videos have not come out just yet, but, tell me as far as, how do you feel with the book and the process? How has that been for you?
Right. I mean, for the first time, these guys wrote a book about my dad. What better story? I'm excited. Mostly just the whole thing kind of makes me kind of mostly just talking about it, y'all. But still, I love it, man. It's a great book.
Well, we've definitely got the love for you and your wife and also your family. I mean, telling that story, I'm sure at times it wasn't the easiest, but I know it brings up memories and feelings. I can't tell people enough. You've got to get the copy. And I know we've had a lot of people reaching out. When's the book going to come out? And now it's officially, you can physically hold it in your hand.
Yes. Yes.
So, Gary, you want to say anything?
No, I encourage you to get the book and help us solve the mysteries that are still in the book and in the material that we need to know. And I think we can get some help out there. We've tried to tell the story just as clearly and honestly and with all the illustrations of all the material that has been passed down to Ricky. And I think people will find it fascinating, but also very disturbing that the FBI took it away from us, as did the media when we introduced this back in about 1990, 30 some odd years ago. So help us, guys.
There are documents and pictures in this book that have never been seen outside the White family. So if nothing else, get it for the photographs and the documents, because otherwise you won't have it. I mean, Gary Shaw is the only one that's got it, and now we put it in the book. So if you're a document or a photographer or a photo guy, this is the book. We filled it up with books or pictures and documents so that we can tell the story even clearer. So
I remember as a young researcher that I just got into it, and I remember seeing the press conference. I wasn't in Dallas that day, but I saw it afterwards. And I got to tell you, I was moved by the story at that point, and I'm even more moved by it 30 plus years later. So, it's been a long time, for the entire story to come out, and a book by, by Ricky and Gary and Brian. I'm proud of you guys. And, I'm going to open up now. Would anybody like to ask these three some questions? Now is your time. I mean, this is not something usual where we have Ricky on in our meetings, but I'm really glad that he's here today. So, please, if you have any questions, unmute and ask away.
I might have, but does somebody else have their hand up?
No, go ahead, Paul.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I just wanted to point out how great it is when we can get family relatives. I did a book review for Kennedys and King on Pipe the Bimbo in Red, and that's Dean Andrews III. Dean Andrews' son is interviewed there by Law and Jeffries, and it's an incredible source of information. And I was just wondering, maybe for the authors, what you want there is like sort of corroboration from the the family member and in getting, I was wondering if the network, I'm going to read the book, so I'm asking this question without having read it, but is there a sort of a challenge there in terms of getting people who can, you know, be in the network and the surroundings and who are there at the time to help in corroborating? Because that's what often happens, I'm sorry to say, with E. Howard Hunt's son and others, is they try and attack the person rather than the message, right? And anyway, if you have any comments on that, and congratulations, I think this is so useful.
I'll make just one comment, Paul. Back when this first came out in 1988, there were people alive that we did talk to and get corroboration. I made copious notes, memorandum of those conversations that I filed away. And that's what Brian and I have used to write this book. And so, yes, we've done a lot of corroborating. There's still a lot to learn, and I'm hoping that you'll step in and help us.
We will. I want to take the time to thank Brian for the word that we use in our book about the spectrographic analysis. I talked about that earlier, Brian. Oh. So I just wanted to thank you for that.
Good. Well, Gary's notes fill four of the largest Tupperware Rubbermaid tubs, and we could have made the book, you know, 4 feet thick. But you know, there's just so much information that Gary's collected over the years and that he got from Rick, and we've condensed it into 300 and how many pages is it?
340
pages. We've condensed Ricky's dad's story into 340 pages, and it's a, you know, as many times as Gary and I sat down and wrote, it just was chilling, some of the stuff that he had collected over, that Ricky's dad had collected over the years. And I can tell you, and some of you may not know, but I spent 22 years as a law enforcement officer. I've interviewed everybody from suspects to witnesses to, you know, complainants. And I can tell you, there's the two most truthful, honest witnesses I've ever talked to are Ed Hoffman and Ricky White. He didn't have a motive to lie.
In fact, he had a motive to hide, if you come right down to it. But his dad wanted this told, and he's brave enough to uphold it. So we're trying to do the best we can with it.
And you're very brave, Ricky. I see Bob's got his hand up. This is Bob Saltzman. He has a question or comment for you.
Just a suggestion, David, to you and Gary, Brian, and Ricky. It would be wonderful if maybe you could return maybe in 3 or 4 months after some of us have an opportunity to read the book, and if you're so inclined to engage in a discussion about the content in addition to your
idea. Thanks, Bob. That's a good idea.
We'll do that.
I think, and I know I've talked to Brian about this, and Ricky, I mean, you're here, so I think what we have a platform. This is the Journey Meeting, where we're kind of, I want to call it the water cooler talk. We get together and share ideas, and then we have a more structured, you know, interview process, which is called the Spotlight Series. And it will spotlight you and Brian and in a group formation to where, you know, you can talk more about the book. It'll be, you know, definitely we want to make sure everybody gets a chance to read it. So sometime later this year, if you're willing, I would love to have you on the Spotlight Series. You know, it's structured. It's usually, you know, 2 to 3 hour deal and you know, we can make it a little longer. We can make it a little shorter, but it's an opportunity for the public to be able to get the book, read it, and then they'll be able to form some questions or some good comments to pass back and then, you know, have some back and forth. I definitely, Bob. Yeah. I want to do that. If you guys are willing to, I think that would help the book and also help the story.
And the advantage of using it in this forum, David, is that if Brian and Gary and Ricky are not physically able to be together during that time, they can join us separately, you know, from wherever their home location is. So I think this would be a terrific forum for that, maybe in 4 to 6 months. Thank you for considering that.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Next person has a question for Ricky and Brian Gary. Just unmute your mic and you can ask away.
David, hi, it's Neil Safferty.
Hi, Neil. Welcome to the welcome to the program.
How are you? Long time no speak.
Yeah, we didn't get a chance to have that beer in Dallas this year, but I was kind of busy. I had my hands full, so please go ahead and talk to the guys there.
Yeah, well, great that you guys could join us, Brian, Ricky, and obviously Gary. I've been promoting this story, actually, funnily enough, since Gary spoke at Chris Gallup's seminar back in 2022, and obviously I was there last year where both Brian and Gary spoke, and obviously I was there at the Trinday Project JFK thing in the DoubleTree. So I'm a big fan of this stuff, and I've been looking into it, you know, significantly myself, and I've ordered the book, and I'm hoping it's going to come over this side of the pond shortly. My question really is, have you validated the witness execution book in terms of authenticating the writing, that it was Roscoe's, that it was Ricky's dad? Because obviously that's the sort of thing that is going to be, and I haven't read the book yet and I'm waiting for it, but that's the sort of thing that's going to be quite big. I mean, you've seen all this stuff with the Albarelli book, presumably. A lot of JFK researchers have been somewhat dismissive about the validation of that book, and I'm just wondering where we are with Roscoe's, you know, witness execution book.
Neil, are you referring to the Green Diary?
Exactly, not the actual diary, but the Green Book with the 28. You
know. Neil, we've seen the whole chapter on the diary that's missing. And what Ricky and Tricia could remember reading over and over again about the Dita Plaza episode. And the Green Book, which, you know, it says 28 witnesses have died in the witness program. Take out the rest later. We've printed full pages of that complete book with all the news clippings and the scribblings and where his father admitted that he fired the shot and where he stood. So the people that are interested in this, like you, will find it very, very helpful in determining for yourself the provenance of the artifacts are without question. The handwriting Ricky has identified as has his mother before she passed has the writings of his dad, and so that we're not concerned about. The typing on the cables and so forth were all pre-1964. Things like that we've been able to identify, and I'm not ready to take it to the FBI and ask them to do it.
That's a fair point, Guy. I'm just wondering whether you had any independent validation, that's all. I mean, I'm not questioning the provenance because I listened to your story and Ricky's and Brian, and, you know, we've gone through the footlocker and the canister and the telegrams. You know, I've bought into this. My question really is, for the sort of wider JFKA research community, is can you independently validate that the witness execution Green Book is in Roscoe's handwriting? Because if you can do that, it's a layup. It's just a done deal, isn't it?
All I can tell you is that it's been identified as Roscoe's, and he actually has his signature in two places in it, along with his military serial number that he wrote down. We didn't write it down. And now, if there's a faker out there 35 years, well, longer than that, before 1971 when it was buried and his dad died and was buried. If there's somebody out there that faked all of this and put it away, we can't find them, and I'm not going to try. Look at what it says. Look at the artifacts themselves. And if that's not enough, we really can't do any more. And we're not telling you, you know, hey, this is the gospel. Don't get us wrong. We're telling the story that was handed down to Ricky, and we're printing everything that we've got and telling you about it. And if you can destroy it without being stupid, like some, then have at it.
Yeah. You Gary, you're preaching to the choir because I've already bought into this. I respect you. I respect Brian. You know. No issues with this at all. And I'm really looking forward to reading the book because I'm hoping it's going to tidy up a lot of loose ends. All I was saying, there are a lot of extremely cynical people, as you all know, in the community, and you know what's going on with the Alberelli story. I'm sure you do. Casey certainly does. I mean, Casey's read that book God knows how many times and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And all I'm saying is that that's the only criticism that you might have.
Thank you, Neil.
I think that's fair enough.
Neil? Is he gone?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I'm here. It's probably fine.
Right. Thank you, Neil.
Appreciate it, guys.
Anything that you can relate on it, we thank you.
And any suggestions you have will certainly be taken seriously.
And for everybody that does get the book and reads it, please write a review on Amazon. It'll help us spread the word a little bit more, even just from the word of mouth. So don't forget Amazon review. Even if it's a short blurb, that's fine. Please review it.
Absolutely. And I see Scott Edwards has his hand up. So, Scott, go ahead and ask your question, sir.
Thank you. I have ordered the book, and I'm excited to find out we'll be able to read it soon. But in the meantime, I was curious, what is your position on whether your dad was the figure in the backyard photographs?
No, I don't have an opinion, really. I just know what other people's done with it, like Jack White. You know, basically that's about all I can tell you because I really don't know very much about the backyard photograph.
I see we've got a question here in the chat log that says, I'll just read it verbatim. I would like to know whether Ricky, Gary, Brian have a clear idea of what happened to Roscoe on the west side of the bridge, whether he assaulted someone in self-defense or whether that was linked to the pool of blood. Would one of you guys like to tackle that question?
I'll tackle it as much as I can. The diary said that he came around the fence and took down a guy. Now, what that takedown means, I don't know. Did he shoot him? Did he knock him in the head? Did he punch him in the stomach or the nose? What we do know is that there was definitely a large pool of blood on the steps that lead up to the fence. And the FBI came in and took photographs away from a guy who had taken photographs with the Dallas Morning News and told them to keep their mouth shut, basically. That's in the book. So we don't know what happened. He doesn't spell out, you know, that he killed somebody else. He may have just knocked him in the head or whatever.
In the diary, Ricky and Tricia independently told us that the diary said Roscoe had written "world over the fence," took man down to protect myself. Now you can have three different scenarios there. To take him down to protect myself, was he afraid that he was going to identify Roscoe? Was he there to protect his team, or you know what was the purpose of taking this man down? And we speculate a little bit about what we think that means, but we don't know for sure because, you know, did he shoot the man? Did he take him down that way? Did he tackle him? Did he bust him up? We don't know, but he thought it was important enough to put it in the diary. So it must have been a significant event, on top of all the other events that was going on at that time. So he clearly made a note of it. And, you know, we'll leave it up to the reader to determine what he meant by that. We have no way of getting inside Roscoe's head and say, well, what did you mean by that? Well, you took a man down to protect yourself.
I think it all comes back to the frame of reference of what Roscoe was thinking compared to what the idea is of everybody else's opinion, what they think it means. So it is one of those things where you're going to have to make up your own mind, you know, what the frame of reference is.
Yeah. And that was one of the key points that Gary and I agreed on. We're not going to speculate. We're not going to try to put words into Ricky's dad's mouth or on paper. We're just going to present the information that Ricky had and was given left by his father to do something with. And that's what we've done. We just put it together as like a legal brief. And here's what we have. And you're the jury. You decide whether there's any credence to the story or not.
And for those of you that are watching, we are with Ricky White, Brian Edwards, and Gary Shaw, the writers of Admitted Assassin. You can now get your book on Amazon and also from the website Peniel Unlimited. There's Brian with the book. I know it's been a talk for the last year when that was going to come out, and I know I've been fielding phone calls, texts, and emails for people that either have or have not ordered it yet, wanting to get their copy in their hand. So I'm really happy to see that it has come to fruition and it's here. And I'm really glad the fact that we have you three gentlemen in the audience today.
Yeah, well, David and Casey, don't worry. I'm coming back Sunday and I have your copies in the car. So
I'm very happy to finally get my copy, and I know Casey is too, to have it in our hands. We're kind of old school. We like to have a physical book in our hands.
Well, this is a story that's been needed to be told for 60 years, so we're pretty proud of it.
Hey, what's going on? I think in Dallas last November was quite emotional for all of us, especially for you guys, on the stage there, and bringing Ricky's story and everything, and his family and his friends and everything. I thought, I had tears streaming down my cheeks, just listening and taking in, that entire scene there. But I was most interested in maybe Ricky can talk a little bit more about when he mentioned that incident when padlocked room that he had one day, he left it unlocked and he went in there and he discovered that he indeed had a photographic lab there. Ricky can give us a little bit more detail about that.
Tell us where that was.
Yeah, I was in Richardson, and that would be on Nottingham. And me and my brother both all kind of knew that it was there. It was a secret place for my father. He kept it locked 90% of the time. And just this one time, it was unlocked, and it just, me and my brother just couldn't wait, to be honest with you, to look in the room. So, I either looked out or he looked out. And we went in there, and I just remember getting in there and remember, photographs hanging and a couple of trays. And what really, really caught our eye in there the most was the footlocker. It sat right in the middle of the room, and he had a gun loading stuff where he loaded his own ammunition. And then there was a black light in there, I think, too. So, that was his room, and we knew it. That was his secret room. So, I think we went in that room twice in the whole time that we were there. I got to see it. And, when my dad was killed and the funeral was over, basically that was the first place that me and Tony went to, was that room, mm-hmm. And it was real weird when we got there. It was empty. It was like nobody was ever even in there.
So all the equipment
was gone? Everything's
gone,
everything. The foot locker.
But you were still living there, right?
Yeah. It's all gone.
Yeah.
There wasn't nothing
there. So we would be safe to assume and conclude that he had good photographic skills.
Okay.
What's interesting, Larry, though, I've asked Ricky that 100 times, I bet. I asked him, your dad had his own dark room. I get that. Mm-hmm. But during the time he was growing up, he only knew his dad for 3.5 years. But that whole time, he doesn't remember his dad taking pictures of the family at Christmas time or birthdays or anything, unusual. You have your own dark room, but where are you taking these pictures? So that, and then Ricky's mom, when she told the HFCA, when they came to interview Rick and his mom, she said he worked in the photo lab. Well, we'd never heard that before. We had to get that from Geneva's audio tape that he worked in the photo lab. Well, if he was a rookie, he must have had some really good skills that they put him in the dark room or the crime scene search group and work in the dark room. So where he learned the dark room, where he learned where he learned photographic skills, you know.
I don't know.
Did he learn that in the Marines?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
That was the only place
we lived on probably.
And that was the only place that I remember, you know, ever seeing any of that stuff, to be honest with you. That's the first time we ever saw the Foot Locker.
And then the next time you saw the Foot Locker was in 82 when your grandfather died.
That's right.
So you didn't know where that Foot Locker had gone.
No, my cousin Tommy Jean found it in there when they were going through everything. And he pulled it out and came running up there and told us that he had found my dad's Foot Locker.
And that was the first time you'd seen it after you moved from Richardson.
That's right.
Yeah. Somebody had a question there, I heard. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Shauna, you wanted to add something?
I'm biting my tongue, hitting stitches. I'm real hesitant because I want to be real respectful to Ricky and what he went through. But I understand he died your father died just 2 years before my dad was moved into the Dallas Police Department and then was a crime scene division photography and then was positioned at the Dallas Fire Department and got all the JFK files from the police department when the House Select Committee on Assassination came in. I was in his photo lab at Dallas City Hall to help with processing some of those things for the HSCA. And so there's a very loose connection there. I've not been able to establish the direct connection between my dad and Ricky's dad, but the fact that they were both BPD employees and dad was a photo expert for the CIA leads some credibility to that connection.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, when Rick found the Foot Locker, he found, I don't know, there must have been two or three dozen, you know, first-generation prints from the original negatives of the crime scene search that the cops did, mugshots, pictures of Tippett, all the evidence that was gathered at the rooming house and at the paint house was, you know, brought back to the police station and laid out on the floor, and they took the pictures. And I suspect that Roscoe took those pictures because he had first generation prints of those artifacts in that Foot Locker when Ricky found it in 82.
So, that's exactly what I had. I helped Dad, and I wasn't there for the whole time, but I was a teenager at that time, processed, and we had first generation too that was hidden in my dad's closet and in the cellar and the barn as well. And some of the exact same ones that Ricky had. I still have those.
Well, and Ricky had shared with us one or two interviews long ago that his mother was told by Roscoe that hang on to these pictures, they'll be worth something someday.
Same thing I was told, but in Dallas when I got a note to Ricky's wife, I later got a phone call and was told not to talk to Ricky and that none of my devices were secure.
I would like to ask the question. I'm sure some people are probably asking the same thing. From the time that the Foot Locker was in the room to the time that your father, you know, was killed, and then you realize that the Foot Locker's gone until it shows back up in, I think you said, 82. Is there any, and I'm not trying to say speculation, but do you know who moved that Foot Locker out of the room and it wound up at your grandfather's?
No, and really and truly, to be honest with you, I stayed there all the time. I can't believe he did it without us even knowing it. Because, you know, I stayed and lived almost with my grandparents.
So there's also a story when Rick was, they had a cabin, and we talk about this in the book, Lake Whitney. And Rick remembers seeing his dad spend most of the day burying this. How big is this box?
Here's a metal box about like this and about that tall.
Yeah, burying a metal box on the property. And Gary and Joe West and Larry Howard and Larry Harris went back there with Rick, and they dug it up with a backhoe and couldn't find it. So obviously Roscoe, I mean, this was shortly before they sold the property. So, you know, something must have spooked Roscoe and thought, I got to get that out of there. So we don't know who dug it up. We know Roscoe buried it. But, you know, we're just speculating that Roscoe probably wanted to get that out of there before he sold the property. Whatever that box was, we don't know. You never did find that box?
Never found.
I have no idea what that box was. But the Foot Locker is a different deal. That was somebody had taken it from Richardson and taken it to Paris, and that's where it was found.
I will tell you this. Roscoe had a half-brother named Walton. And Walton told me in 19... 19- probably 1991, that the FBI came to him 2 weeks after Roscoe died, asking him if Roscoe had left him any boxes or any books or materials.
So the FBI is on him
real quick.
Real quick. And so a lot of that is the FBI is following Ricky and Tricia for 2 days in 1987, 88. They were following Ricky and Tricia when they hadn't even talked to him yet. Now, why was the FBI's interest so intense that they would follow civilians? Are they afraid?
We have records of that surveillance.
It's in the book. We have their actual logs that they follow. In fact, one of the days they followed the wrong car. That's how inept they were. So, you know. Okay.
All right. Hey, guys. Thank y'all so much.
Well, thank you again for coming on, and I will work with Brian and Gary, and we'll like I say, in 4 to 6 months, we'll get together and we'll do the spotlight, and you know, we'll do a longer time when we can schedule it all together correctly. But thank you again, and congratulations on the book. You know, it's really great that the story is out there, and it's in print. So definitely pick up your copy of The Minute Assassin. I want to thank again Brian Edwards, J. Gary Shaw, and of course Ricky White. Thank you very much.
Just before they go, I want to let Gary and Brian know that I'm working on the article for Dealey Plaza UK that I'm doing. I wanted to wait till the book was out so it can coincide. So I'm going to get that over there, and hopefully we can get it on their site soon to help promote the book.
Thank you.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
Thank all of y'all.
Thank you, guys.
See ya.
All right. Well, hey, you never know who's going to drop in and, you know, take part in our meetings. So that's one of the great things I like about the Journey meetings. We are pushing at 3:17. I'm going to make the quick announcement here. Again, let me see here real fast if Mr. Denton is in the room. Well, he's still signed in. We are having the spring conference, Prodigy of KCSI Dallas. Usually we always do something with the JFK Historical Group, and we're still doing that. But Dave's getting a chance to kind of step back and not have to be in charge of, you know, the bookings and you know, the logistics of it. That's where I'm coming in at. But I'm also getting help from Brian and Casey on that as well. It's not a one man operation. So, again, it's going to be April 12th and 13th. It's going to be at the Johnson County Community College in the auditorium. Everybody's welcome to show up. I am working on getting the, Zoom portion. I have to make sure that I don't want to, you know, offer Zoom if we can't have a good quality connection. So as long as I make sure that, that'll happen, then for those of you that can't travel, you'll be able to see it live in person, and eventually, yes, the videos will be available for digital download or USB flash drives. The student price, and of course, the reason why we want to do a student symposium is to get the younger generation involved in this. They are paying a lot lesser price than the general public. For their fee, it's only going to be $5 a day to get in, and I want to make it accessible for anybody in the general public and the research community to attend. It's $25 a day. There's 2 days, so you're looking at a $50 conference. There won't be any, you know, your food costs will be on your own, your travel costs will be on your own, your hotel room costs will be on your own. So I can tell you that it's definitely cheaper to stay in Johnson County than it is in Dallas, Texas. Especially on hotel rooms alone. And with the two airports in Kansas City, Missouri, you're able to fly in probably at a cheaper price as well. We're right in the Midwest in the Bible Belt of the United States. And we've got seating capacity for 240 people. So if you, you know, once we announce the tickets, you're going to want to get yours as soon as you can, because once the room fills up, and I'm hoping with between students and the general public, you know, we don't have any places for standing room. It's everybody has to have a seat. They made sure to stress that to me that, you know, there's a certain amount of capacity in that room. This is the first time that we've had something like this at my college. And hopefully, depending on how it goes, I know we've had things at Albany Central College, and that's always a fun place to go to. Maybe we can alternate years, and it gives us another place to get the younger generation involved in this quest for the truth. This is not just an old man or old woman's game. This is getting everybody involved. No matter what way you look at it, the day that November 22nd, 1963 happened, not just the United States, but the world changed. We lost our innocence. We lost our president. And for the Kennedy family, they lost a father, a brother, and a husband. We owe it to, you know, to the world to keep researching this and to keep searching for the truth. And that's why we do what we do. We are working on a shoestring budget. This is my little time to climb up on the soapbox and e-beg, I guess you would call it. But we are working on a shoestring budget. And if anybody would like to make a donation to help with the conference, it would be greatly appreciated. You can always make that donation through the ProjectGFK.com website on the homepage where it says donate now. This is something that it's kind of the test the waters as a student symposium. I know we had one way back when I was, you know, a newbie into this, back in, 94, 95, when we brought, Marina Oswald Porter up to, Olathe, Kansas, my hometown. And, I tell you what, I think this is going to be a great presentation, a great opportunity to bring in the younger generation. And I definitely want to throw out a great shout to Doug Horn for coming out. He's going to be speaking on Friday and on Saturday. I know Doug's in the room. I'm extremely happy to have him here or have him coming to the college. And I'm just going to throw this out real fast. His two presentations are going to be the two brain examinations following the autopsy on the body of JFK. And that's booked for Friday, and Saturday is the JFK Skull X-Rays, A Trail of Deceit, 1963 and 79. Doug is a quality researcher, a quality speaker, and I'm excited that, you know, he chose to join us, to be able to talk to not only the research community as a whole, but being able to reach the students at the college. And I know I'm working on trying to get some high school kids in as well. Maybe they can do a field trip to come out. Doug, you're in the room. Would you like to talk for a few minutes?
Thank you, David. Thank you, David, and for Brian, who reached out to me. And I'm looking forward to seeing you two again, Casey. I'm really excited about the two presentations that I want to give because they're recent. I mean, I've created both of these, you know, about 6 months ago, and they basically represent decades of work by me, kind of a final summation of a lot of my work with the medical evidence. And this is probably going to be my last rodeo, my last conference. I have not gone to many conferences in the past. I stayed away from most of them, and I did go to one in Pittsburgh last November, and it went very well for me. And it was a good conference. And so that was encouragement to maybe do it one more time. And I'm excited about doing this one because it really is important to bring in younger people and to teach them the basic lesson that I want to impart is to teach them that you need to learn to be an independent thinker and not defer to authority because that's what all the Warren Commission supporters and the lone nutters want you to do. They want you to defer to authority. And that's led nowhere in this case except to obfuscation and cover-up. So what these two presentations are about is really about telling you what did the authority figures say about the brain photographs in the archives, what did the authority figures say about the skull x-rays, and how were they so badly wrong? And I'll be talking about that. They were intentionally wrong in each case. And so I'm looking forward to this very much. thank you, Brian, for inviting me, and thank you, David and Casey, for bringing me in on this. And I'm looking forward to it, so thanks.
Well, thank you again, Doug, and I know I'm looking forward to having you in Kansas City, well, Johnson County, Kansas. I call it Kansas City because it's in the metro, and getting the opportunity to speak to the students. I think this is a great opportunity to reach out and, you know, bring more younger researchers involved in the, you know, to get them involved in this. Cause let's face it, we're all getting old. We're all losing our hair and, you know, we're tired, but we keep doing what we're doing, in order to keep this case alive, keep it relevant and, get more people involved in it. So, I'm going to throw up the, information here real quick. Like I say, again, definitely keep checking out the website. I know we have a signed contract, so it's binding. We've already given the deposit. It's not going to change. We're definitely having the event, again, April 12th and 13th. For those of you that want to go ahead and start, maybe doing a quick Google search of where the place is located at, the campus is located at 12345. That's a strange address. I thought it was strange too, but 12345 College Boulevard, Overland Park, Kansas, at the, Johns County Community College. The room that we're having it in, let me see if I can just pull up a quick photograph of what the place looks like. It's going to be a very comfortable, seating area. There's a big screen in the room. Let me see if I can pull this up. Give me just a quick sec. Okay. Let me share my screen again. I mean, it's your standard, you know, college auditorium, but, there's plenty of room for like I say, 240 individuals. Obviously, if you're a speaker and you want to bring books to sell, that's obviously allowed. It's an opportunity to put things in front of the new people that we're bringing into this. The students get a chance to see this. I know that obviously we're going to have some books for what we just talked about with Admitted Assassin available for purchase. So again, April 12th, 13th, 2024 at the Johns County Community College. It is $25 per day, so $50 for the 2-day conference. I'm sorry, student symposium. $5 for students each day. And it gives you an opportunity to come out and reach the younger generation. Paul, you've got your hand up. Do you want to add something here?
Well, that's actually, you're touching on one thing. If someone would like to be a guest speaker, or there's some openings, or do you have a...
I still have some spots available. I know we're going to have, we're looking at doing just 7 speakers per day. So we're going to have 14 speakers, or 14 presentations, not 14 speakers. I know I'm doing kind of the intros, and I know I have a presentation to give. Doug's going to give a Friday and a Saturday presentation. If you are wanting to speak, please send me an email and I can see if I can fit you into the schedule. If we could, the bad part about it is with running on a shoestring budget, you know, paying for the room per hour, which is what I have to do, we are only at a limit of, 8 hours each day. And it's, let's face it, it's $100 a day to, or $100 an hour to get the room, plus set up and tear down time. So, okay. Unfortunately with, I know David didn't, he was able to give us a donation to help cover some of the costs, and I kicked in some of my own money to do this. And as I think it's important, and, anytime that you're putting on a conference, luckily we're not having it at a hotel where you're stuck with a $13,000 overhead of food and beverage minimum, but I still have an overhead I have to meet. I have to pay for insurance, the room, equipment that, maybe I don't have that I got to cover. So, it's, okay. it, it's one of those things where if anybody wants to help, make a donation and help. I would greatly appreciate it, and it would mean the world to, you know, to the group okay. putting this on. And if you want to speak, definitely send me an email.
I'll send you an email, Dave, and I have two small points, if I may, that I think the audience might be interested in. And first, I want to echo what Brian Edwards said about, you know, if you have a nice heartfelt feeling about a book or whatnot, to write Amazon, because the playbook by the opposition to get these, you know, to infect or to contaminate the comments is in effect. Okay, we've seen contamination. I mean, we've seen bona fide good criticism, but, you know, when it's, like, really off the wall, you can tell. So, we're not looking for people to prop anything up, but if somebody has heartfelt things to say on Amazon, it's helpful to the writers. The second thing I wanted to mention is I'm teaming up right now with Jeff Meek and David Boylan on a very exciting project. It's a research project where we're going to get the cooperation from Lancer so far and others, where we're going to be sending out some survey questions to see where the research community stands on what they think happened. It has nothing to do with proving a conspiracy, but more in this case having, you know, what do they feel about certain motives? What do they feel about certain groups? And we have a list of about 250 to 300 researchers that will be getting a link to the survey. We'll probably be presenting results at one of the conferences in the fall, some of the results. And it'll be a series of about 6 to 10 surveys. They take about 2 to 3 minutes to fill out. We'll be sharing the information, you know, maybe on a few podcasts or media, and we'll be discussing it. And these will be followed up by highly professional interviews with some of the best specialists in the field. So, you know, we want to get some groupthink into this, you know, like group contact. And some people, just to see the questions, you'll enjoy it. And you may want to send us things you think we should measure. Okay, so we're starting off. Our first survey is going out within a week or 2 weeks. It's on motive. So if any of you receive that, or, you know, maybe, Dave, I can send you the questionnaire. You can look at it. And if you feel that it could be something that you would like to plug and send a link to your audience to, we can go from there. But it should be, I think, very, very interesting. And we're going to see where there are gaps in our thinking and what, you know, where, you know, who thinks what and what are the different theories and all that. So anyway, just keep your heads up, everyone, for that. And thank you, David, for having us on your today to speak. And really good luck for that event in Kansas City. I'm going to see what I can do because I teach. And as Doug said, you know, reaching out to this next generation is crucial.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Paul. And I tell you what, we are going to take about a 90-second break. So just stay in the room, and I will be right back.
Paul, Rick Bucarelli, I just sent you a message with my email. I'd be glad to participate in the survey.
And I will certainly send it to you.
And I'll put a review on Amazon, too.
Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome. You know, thank you so much. And, you know, it should be a good one based on the footnotes you highlighted.
Yeah.
So you should know what you're talking about.
I won't contaminate. That's
so. And you know what? I'll send you an email if ever you have some questions or anything. Let me know.
That'd be great. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. And anybody who comes up to Quebec City, hey, it's a wonderful city. And you want to have a coffee or something? You know, certainly drop me a call. I'll do that. I'll do that for you, Rick.
I appreciate it. Thank you. I'm a Flyers fan, so I may have to come up for a Canadians game, Canadians Flyers game.
Oh, good God. What were they called?
The Broad Street
Bullies. Yeah, the Broad Street Bullies.
I was there during those years. So.
With Dave the Hammer Schultz, believe
Dave
me.
Dave Schultz, yep. They were hockey was pretty interesting back then.
So. Fred Giroux, I remember him.
Thanks again, though.
But Bobby Clark was just an amazing leader. That guy was. He had serious diabetes. You probably know that, but he's a diabetic. Yeah. For him to have done what he did on the ice is crazy.
Okay, hey, thanks again. I appreciate it.
Okay, sorry about that, guys. Hey, I like it when you guys can carry on when I'm having to, as the host, you don't always get a chance to take a commercial break, and yeah, you can only hold it for so long. So I know that Bob's got a thing where it says donations, how to make. You can go to the Prodigy FK website. I will do a quick show here real fast. If you go to the homepage at projectjfk.com and scroll down to where it says help our cause, you can make a donation by clicking the donate now button through PayPal. They accept PayPal, MasterCard. We accept PayPal, MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and American Express. And while we're already on here, I'll go over to where it says, so I can move this out of my way. If you click on the events tab, under the events tab, you will see videos of past events that we've held. These are like our journey meetings. You can find the replays here. And if you scroll down past the replays of our journey meetings, and there's a lot of them, we've been doing this for 2 years now, going on three. You will find the chat logs that you can download, those text files I spoke about earlier. And then if you want to take us on the road with you to go, listen on a audio device or in your vehicle, you can always download the MP3, drop it onto a flash drive or an SD card and put that into your vehicle and take us with you or listen to us on your phone. You'll also find the Spotlight series, which is the one I was speaking of earlier with one we'll book for Ricky White, Gary Shaw, Brian Edwards. And then I want to definitely do one with the Chokeholds book and the five authors that were involved in that. So, the website is a plethora of information that you can go and, not only watch our videos, see photographs and digital scans that you will not see anyplace else. There's a lot of those that are from the Gary Shaw collection that are first-generation copies. They were scanned in. I know we've talked about scanning over the last couple years, but you can find those there as well. So we're not just a quick come to the website. On average, I get good comments where people will go on. And they will spend hours at a time going through, whether they're watching videos or looking at photographs. And the nice thing about it is if you go to the affiliated website tab, which is underneath the more tab at the very far right, you will be linked to other sites or podcasts. So again, anybody that sees something that is not on our website and you think it should be on there, send me a link and let me know, hey, this should be on there, and tell me why it needs to be on there. We've grown. The website started in 2018 as a project that I told Brian and Casey. I said, we've got to get out there and do what nobody else is doing. We need to bring everybody together. We need to be making available things that you're not going to find on a different website. And, Google searches are great to have, but you can't find everything on Google. And if you do try to find it, one of the main reasons why that I started this was I wanted to make it available for the younger generation to go to a location, one site, then they can venture out into the, area of the internet, but it gives them a place to go and to start. If you ever gone online, I know we all have, looking for something on the JFK assassination, you will spin your wheels trying to find what you're looking for. There's tons of websites out there. I am proud to say that we are number one. We have been for quite some time. We used to always get beat out by a constitutional website, but we have not. We've been in the number one spot now for 7, going on 8 months of the top research of a research site on history, in particular the JFK assassination. And we can't do that if we don't have people coming to, you know, to our website. And we can't be doing that if we don't have things to put out there for you guys to come back and check on and to see the new stuff. So, you know, it's a team effort between between me and Brian and Casey and you guys as a research group. Speaking of our guy we haven't heard from today, Casey is in the room. I know he missed the last meeting with us back in December, so he got off on not setting 6 hours, but he's here today. So Casey, why don't you give us some food for thought, and what have you been working on here lately?
Well, let me say something real quick here, David, to all the people who have come in online here. Thank you guys very much for joining the presentation of the program that that David Knight has worked on diligently, probably for the past 4 or 5 years, even though we've been online for a little more than 2 years. I want to point out several people. Paul, I have not read your book. I am going to read your book and the other four authors with that. I'm very interested in reading, and most of the people who know me know that I read books and I rip them apart. I've just gotten through reading three books. Actually, two of them were a double book, and it was about the United States Air Force, and I was a little bit taken back by some of the material inside there, primarily because I'm not really sure if all this information that was in those two in a double volume is accurate. But at the same time, it opened up some more lines of thought in those particular fields. But at the same time, Paul, I want to read you guys' book, and I'm very interested to see how you guys put it together, and especially if Jimmy D is involved in that. I want to see what he put into that. But, yeah, I'm very interested in reading that. I'm also interested in reading anything that comes out, but at the same time, kind of like what David said, there's only so many hours in the day, and most of the time I'm reading, writing, and putting things together. The interesting thing that I also want to point out all the work that Larry Schnaff and some of the individuals who have really gone out on the line as lawyers and try to promote and uncover a lot of the material on a legal basis, because I know a lot of us will sit back and say, you know, we've kind of given up on that legality. Don't give up, because you have and we have very good people in the lawyer's profession trying to uncover by law the things that should have been opened up a long time ago, and these guys are still on that, and Larry's one of our top individuals, and I just want to point out that about him and pat him on the back for all the Zoom meetings that he has been involved with, and all the other Zoom meetings that are out there that I've tried to get involved with. And even Paul, a couple of years, I saw some things online, haven't got through all that. But it's interesting. I've just been contacted by, God, I hate to say older people, but I'm 74, so I've been contacted by probably several 80-year-old people who want to know more about the Kennedy assassination, since it's been online here probably within the last 4 or 5 months. And I'm gonna go speak to them at a breakfast, and there's only gonna be about 6 to 8 of them. But that's how you market things. That's how you sit down and talk to people. But these people are very interested. They want to know why the media has not brought this stuff out. Well, that's gonna be my responsibility to try to tell them why it hasn't been brought out, or why other people may have been involved in this, but they're interested from the point of view that I think they believe that there was a conspiracy or that something took place. most of them believe that the mafia was behind it, and if that Oswald was directly involved in it. But I'm going to sit down with them on Monday and probably talk with them for about 2 hours and kind of get their feeling. So that's where I'm at right now, other than the fact that I'm trying to continue to not only do research but also to teach, and that's been an interesting thing in my life, and I want to point out to the rest of you guys out there how important David Knight is to this program. He is a scholar. He is top 10% of students at Johnson County Community College. Even as a student, he's been asked to be an RA, which I think is phenomenal. And he's been asked to speak before, I think, the Board of Regents and to give some information about what he's been doing. He's an expert in a lot of different things that most of us have no idea how to handle those things. And I, being one of them, I'm limited on my technology, but I can certainly rely on the technology of David Knight. But I just want to pat him on the back for the amount of things that he has done and kept up with this fantastic thing that we're doing here, and we've been doing it for 60 years. So that's about all I got, David. I think we had a great program today, and God, we could go off in a whole bunch of different areas, and I could sit there and talk with Larry Rivera forever, and probably Doug Horn.
Casey, how's your back?
Well, it's getting better. This is the this is my first anniversary since that wreck, and I'm still here, so I'm standing up and I'm walking, and I did not go to the parade, so, but that was a good thing. So for God's sake,
we've been on the JFK Facts podcast. We've been having an interesting phenomena lately, in that there are people of our age, over 70, that are suddenly becoming reconnected with the case. And, well, there's two categories. One category of people that kind of lived through it, but we really didn't get involved. And then there are people that suddenly now in their 70s or something's happened. Either they saw the movie by the Parkland doctors, or something's happened, and they've gotten reengaged in the case again. And kind of life went on. They had their kids. They had their jobs. Now they're getting refocused in. So it's an interesting time right now.
There's a whole bunch of us that have never disengaged.
Well, of course, yeah, but the interesting ones are the ones that you ask them, why are you, you know, so what happened? Why are you suddenly interested again, you know? And there's something has happened in the last year or two that has gotten them reengaged. I mean, and it could be simply that they're retired now and they have more time to focus on things of interest. But
I remember that tagline, Larry, the story that won't go away. Where'd we hear that before? Oh, yeah. What got the Records Act established was the JFK film by Oliver Stone.
Right.
I know that I can second that. Where I've had, you know, some of the older people I run into on campus, they're like, you're putting on a symposium about JFK, and then I hear some of the younger students are like, well, yeah, but Oswald was convicted and he was tried and convicted and he was found guilty. I said, you need to come to the symposium. He was never tried. He was never convicted. And he was killed before he ever, you know, got to a courthouse. So I said, you know, you definitely need to learn your history. And, you know, I throw out the fact of, you know, I get asked the question, well, why do I have to learn about something that happened before I was ever born? I said, it's not the fact of history repeating itself. It's history echoes. And I said, you got to understand the past in order to understand when it comes back around again, you're more informed. And I know I've had a lot of good rapport with the younger students. And of course, I'm 49 as a student in college. But
well, David, you know, that the answer, there's a very, very crisp example. The Secret Service destroyed records in 1994 about the travel, right? The travel in the fall of 63. When they were asked by the ARB to produce them. Young people now, you know, a prime example is no one got punished for that. So then when January 6th occurs and the Secret Service are asked for their emails, they're destroyed. Why? Because no one gets punished. And this past week, not to get political, and this is not political, but the news about Biden's records just shows it's a really difficult question because you don't want people being criminally charged when they make mistakes. On the other hand, if people continue to mishandle records and don't get punished, then records are either going to be destroyed or they're not going to be properly managed.
Yeah, it sets a dangerous precedent, especially right. With documents. You know,
and this kind of goes to also back to what Joe said. The Kennedy case is not a historic. It's not simply an event that happened in history. It is continuing to affect the way our government operates today.
Absolutely, I couldn't agree more.
To the current, that it's not that you're learning that JFK was killed in 1963. It's like, you know, the government. People have learned in the government how they can get away with things and how they can do things, and unless people get punished, and it becomes clear, you know, that if you do certain things, the consequences will flow. Because now the common thing is, I take responsibility. Well, okay, what does that mean? Does that mean just you go before the press and say I'm responsible, but they never pay a price? Anyway, I digress.
Well, Larry, let me point out a couple things to you in response here. I am seeing a resurgence or maybe a renaissance. Maybe we're coming out of the dark ages. I'm not sure, but maybe we're going into the dark ages, however you want to look at that on a political spectrum. But at the same time, there are a lot of individuals who have contacted me, and they're older. They want to know why I've done this for almost 60 years. Why have, and I tell them, I said, I'm not the only one. I said, my God, I said, I'm a handful of a lot of political researchers, but I said, there's new authors out there that are digging deeper than we even had an opportunity to dig into. And it's because of the precedents that we set as, younger individuals back during the time, and also the younger individuals maybe being the sons and daughters of some of these people that are now coming forward with information that is rapidly catching on fire for some of us and saying, you know, there might be an end to this thing. I don't know if there will be. Gary Shaw told me the other day, he says, I'm not sure if I'm going to make it to the end of the time when we actually find out what took place. But he says, I'm just going to continue going on. And I think that's what we do. I had a lady ask me the other day, she goes, so you feel pretty good about some of the material that you found that there was a conspiracy? I said, well, I believe, number one, there was a cover-up. I said, you have to look at the cover-up first. And then after you realize that there was a cover-up, and not just at the federal level. Holy cow! Almost all levels, if you look at this. But at the same time, she said, "Well, what are you going to do if you actually find out what took place?" And I said, "Well, I'm not sure what I can do, but I said I know some lawyers that we are connected to, and they keep this thing not necessarily on the back burner. It's now being put on the front burner, and it's being exposed to a lot more people. And I think that's probably one of the reasons why we have so many older people that are kind of sitting back saying, you know, I want to take another look at this. But also, I think a lot of them have seen the Parkland doctors. And I'm getting messages all the time from saying, God, why didn't we know about this back then? So that's one of the things that I have to address. And to be honest with you guys, I think most of you already knew this, but I know about 12 years ago, we already knew that the Parkland doctors were supposed to be coming out on the 50th anniversary, but never came out. And I kept looking for it, and all of a sudden it comes out on the 60th. Well, I don't want to get it tied up into, you know, who has the rights for what, but at the same time, we argue about that all the time, who has the right to put what out and so on and so forth. But at the same time, some of these people have seen this and they go, well, why didn't we know this back then? And so those are some of the questions I have to answer. to the best of my ability, and a lot of you guys who are out there are asking or at least trying to answer those questions to the best of your ability to the people who you talk to. So
anyone here has a chance to talk to witnesses or family members of witnesses, the message we have to get across is that there should be an obligation to history. And we were just talking about this the other night, how Ben Bradley, who was so friendly with John Kennedy, how does he just sit by idly and let this official story, which his newspaper endorse? How does he let a person, how did he let the murder of one of his best friends get away with it? And, you know, there are people in Dallas and Texas that have information that they have not come forward with yet. And so one of the things is when people get older, they, like Paul Landis, 88 years old, sometimes people want to get things off their chest. But I think if you know anyone that knows witnesses or has information, appeal to their sense to history that, you know, because when they pass away, whatever they knew is gone forever, unless they've shared it with their kids. But it's always better to come from their voice.
How about all the African-Americans that were lining the parade there on Elm Street? We've never even been able to identify not a single one.
Right.
All right?
Right.
And what kind of stories they have, you know, and they were suppressed.
Right. So we need to, but if you know anyone that has information, appeal to their sense of history, because they're a piece of something greater. And maybe they didn't say something in the 60s and 70s and 80s because they're afraid that something would happen to them. But hopefully in the passage of time now, you know, they can be freer to say something. So I just want to say that we try to appeal to the sense of history.
Larry, I appreciate you saying what you just said, because when I came out with Dad's story, I was scared to death. But since I did, I've now had two cops, one in Lindale and one in Ben Wheeler, who are now in their late 80s, and John Carrington lives 20 minutes from me. One interrogated Ruby. The other one kept documents before the FBI came in and cleared off the desk. And they have copies of this stuff. But I knew with this research, I know how to tell a story, but I don't know that it may only have one chance to talk to these retired officers. I need someone to help mentor me, come up with a list when I physically go visit with them. I need someone to step up.
This is really important. Because when we are going through asking for records, like the people that are looking for the records, they only look to where the records should be, right? And
right.
We all know people, I mean, it's happened to me many times in cases where someone takes records home, and then you think you've looked at all the records, and then someone comes into the deposition and they have these records that they have sitting at home.
Like my dad and these two cops. I need these research. I'm not a researcher. I'm living the story, and so are these cops. I don't want to make a mistake when I go talk with them.
So if people, like when you have witnesses, one of the things, do you have any records at home? Like, because people, and maybe some in the early, they may be afraid that they took stuff, right? You know, but now they're at the end of their lives. And if they have stuff at home, that's really, because you know what happens sometimes is people die and their widows throw stuff away. They don't realize it's significant to them. So, you know, that has records. God, this is part of what David does. He, you know, David and Gary, and they're digitizing records. So to the extent anybody comes across people that have records at home, please, at the very least, have them. You got a cell phone. Start taking photographs.
Bob, these elderly men don't know how to do that. I need to physically go. They've invited me to physically go see them, but I want to be prepared with questions. You guys have been working on 60 years. I've only been at this 5 years.
Who was your father again?
Freddie Spainauer. Freddie Philman Spainauer. He was
how do you spell the last name?
In the Navy, a photo and tele. And I posted it earlier, but he was, the agency abandoned him at the police department, in the fire department. They needed someone still in Dallas after everything was disbanded. And I've got documentation on his military career and his intelligence career. He did aerial photo recon. He set up the lenses in Gary Powers' plane and the camera lenses. I have all the documentation on all this stuff.
Was he in Japan?
Yes, sir. He was. I have pictures of him in Japan on the USS Lisa. Pardon?
Was he there when Oswald was there?
I haven't been able to get the files on that. I have a list of all the countries he went to, including Guam, the war tribunal crimes, the hangings that MacArthur said, and which is tied to the assassination, said we only hung four and there were no pictures. Well, my dad was a photographer. I had the pictures. It was tied to the Japanese gold, just like the German gold. And I have things from Dallas, and I've had Gary Shaw at my house. I've had other researchers, Neil Sethe. It's just a work to get these records from the government. And when I go talk to these police officers, I'm not armed as a researcher. I'm a CIA kid. I didn't know not to look at this till 2014 when I found out everything when I was 54. And I need the list of questions of what you would want asked of these police officers, not just see their materials. One guy said, I interrogated Ruby. I interrogated Oswald. And he said that they had 9 transcriptionists in a back room. As they listened to the interrogation tapes, they typed it up with carbons, taped it under the bottom desk drawers. When the FBI came in and swiped everything off the desk, there was 9 police officers who got the copies of them, these interrogation transcripts, and took them home. And this one guy has his copy.
I'm seeing the there's a guest book for your dad when he passed away.
Right. And I have he wrote so much. Yeah, I did audio recordings, video for 15 or 20 years when I started writing and taking notes when I was at Dallas City Hall in his photo lab helping him process photo prints for the HSCA. I was 17, and his photo lab was right underneath where Ruby had shot Oswald 14 years before. And I have pictures and proof of that as well. I have the pictures. I just need to know. I know how to tell Dad's story. It's like Ricky White. It's just his story. But if I go, I'm not a consummate researcher interviewing others on what list of questions I should be asking them now that they're in their 80s and some of them early 90s. I have one chance at it when I go visit them. And it's because my friends who I visit with and I have Zooms with had not tell people. They start stepping up. It's like they want to know the answers before they die, or they want to talk like, Ehrhard Hunt did. It was very heart-wrenching when I met other agency kids that realized that I wasn't alone. And y'all are doing amazing work. David Knight, Casey Quillen, Gary Shaw, all you guys are doing amazing work of keeping this story alive. It needs to be told. The truth needs to be out there, even if it's ugly.
Very well said, Shauna. The one thing that we have to look at, and not to sound morbid, but let's face it, we're all born with a death sentence. Time and place is unknown. But when you're working in this case, just like what we're doing today, this once you get it either in writing, in audio, or in video, it becomes part of the historical record. And once we shuffle off, these videos are hopefully still going to be around. I know my kids, I already told them, I said, I don't give a shit when I kick the bucket. Keep the website going. Keep the YouTube channel going. And here's the files. It's not just for what we're doing the next 5 years, 10 years. This is the next, however hell long it's going to take to get the answer, if we ever get it, but to keep the research alive and, to keep the historical record intact. I know there's a lot of times where, we've all, well, not all of us, but a majority of us have went out and spoke to an eyewitness or spoke to a fellow researcher. We've gone to the conferences. Those conference videos are not always just about a researcher reading something and giving a PowerPoint presentation or a lecture. Sometimes you get eyewitnesses. You get like what we had with the panel discussion with Ricky White in December. The year before that, we had the panel on Lafitte. These are key points. I'm just talking recent. There was eyewitness interviews that were done way back, decades ago, back in the 60s, right after this happened. the moment that that person goes online or goes in front of somebody and they record it or it's written about, it becomes part of the historical record. We have to keep that going for the future generations to keep researching this. I want to say, you know, thank you for the kind words for what I do and what Brian and Casey and Gary Shaw does. I mean, this is something that, you know, wasn't something I planned. You know, when I was a little kid, I was going to be researching the JFK assassination when I'm, you know, damn near 50. But I've kept at it for the years that I've done it, and the associations, the friendships that I've made over the years, and the amount of people I've been able to speak to, eyewitnesses, fellow researchers, authors, you know, it's ingrained in me now. And that's why I do what I do. I knew way back, well, 2021, I said, we've got to start having something more than just at conference time. We've got to have something that we can meet throughout the year and not wait till conference time, because let's face it, by the time conference time happens, sometimes people are in poor health. They've passed away. You know, let's meet and discuss these things. And then while we're at it, let's try to invite the people that we want to hear from. Sometimes that works out great and sometimes it doesn't. But we do what we do, and I do what I do to keep the program open and a platform for all of us to get together in order to share the ideas and to share the research. That's what this is all about. It's not just one of us, it's all of us.
Thank you, David. Really appreciate you. It's an inspiration, and it helps witnesses overcome their fears, because those fears are credible. And I can know where I don't plan on ever competing with the research community. I just want to get the answers like you do.
David, you, at the age that you're at, compared to the age that we're at, you're probably going to outlive all of us. You're going to be carrying this torch for the next 25 years, probably, you know? So, you know, there you go.
Well, I appreciate that, Larry. I know that it's not always easy trying to do the balancing act. You know, it's one of those things, but here's the thing, it has to be done.
And
you know,
I think the case is in very good hands, you know, with your leadership.
Well, I tell you what, I see Bob, he's got his hand back up again. I'm sorry I couldn't get to you a while ago, Bob. Go ahead.
Well, it's just you revisited the topic. I was just going to make a comment from 15 minutes ago as a result of Casey's remarks. And it was just another data point. Casey made his comment about who we need to communicate this to, and the demographic, and Larry added some perspective. And I just wanted to confirm that, I started going around the country giving presentations in 1970, and I've lost count of the number of times I've done it. But 98% of those groups were college students, and I had a rationale for that, planting seeds at a young age and then letting them grow. And, in fact, I have countless stories where that's the case. In the last week, I've accumulated, several hundred requests from people for me to repeat something that I did 5 years ago, which in effect was a one-person JFK symposium. And that was booked a few days ago, so I'm going to be doing a JFK thing for a whole day on April 20th on a Saturday so people can get to it. But the point I was going to make was, number one, the interest was quite overwhelming, and it was from two fundamental age demographics, college-age students and even younger, and seniors. Mm-hmm. This was almost an inverse bell-shaped curve. And I see several people shaking their heads, including Casey, and it's interesting that I would say 40-somethings, 50-somethings, I hear less frequently from than I do from seniors, resurgents, and college-age students.
It's the 40s and 50-somethings are busy with life. They're raising kids. You know, they're working.
Indeed.
You know, so there's you're young. You're in school. You've got nothing to do but read stuff. And
yeah,
older. Yeah, it's interesting that all these little anecdotes are all being reinforced.
And I intend at the time that I do this, this was just confirmed yesterday, so I'm putting my act together now, and as I said, I'm repeating something that I did in in early 2020, early 2019. I can't remember exactly. But I'm going to do a little survey, but it's going to be microscopic. But one thing I'd like to gather is, you know, if people want to share, what's your age group? And so if people do attend, and there's no fee for this, it's completely free. And so the only way I can get that information is ask them to sign up. And that's just to manage logistics, you know, number of seats we need. The last time I did it, there were about 125 people, and I have no idea what to expect this time. And if I may, while I have the rostrum, and I'll make it very brief, I did have a time to chime in on this on Thursday night, Larry, on the JFK Facts podcast. I did put it in the chat, but got no reaction. But there was a reference made to the Washington Post, and certainly because most of you know Jefferson Morley is an accomplished and esteemed reporter for the Post and has great credentials there. In 1973, I was invited to give my JFK presentation to the executive staff of the Washington Post. And I had that opportunity because I knew Howard Simons, who was the managing news editor for the Post, because he went to the same college that I went to. And Benjamin Bradley was in the room the entire time and Catherine Graham walked in and out. And it sounds like I'm name dropping, but at the time I had no idea what was going on. But Bob Woodward also came into the room, and I have had contact with Woodward over the years since then. And if you think about the timing of the winter of 1973, they were very interested, but another Washington news story displaced the whole Kennedy thing, if you remember what happened.
Hold on a second. So are you saying that so Bradley was in the room when you were speaking?
Yep.
Was he asking questions of you?
I can't, too long ago for me to remember. I know Simons did, and I had film and slides. I showed them.
Because the story that – so just a little – the reason this came up was Jeff released the tape he had – taped interview he did of Marina Oswald in 96. Had never been heard before. He had originally done it for a Washington Post piece that got killed or wasn't pursued. And that was very frustrating for him. And we were talking about when a paper like the Post, they're competing with the New York Times, right? And if you piss off the CIA, then you're not going to have the same contacts the New York Times has. And so there's a competitive, even though they're both in the news business, there's also a competitive thing going on where they don't want to take positions that are going to jeopardize their relationship with the CIA, which then will prevent them from getting information that maybe the New York Times could. And it just, that rolled out that, you know, how could the paper led by Ben Bradley, who was a friend of JFK, agree to, like, not let this story go? But, Bob, it looks like something happened between 73.
Right, so that's a 23-year difference in the time period. So
happened in that time period that the Washington Post was no longer interested in running that story.
Right, and just because Larry made a reference, I know there are very few people left, David, and you probably want to wrap up, but this interview that Morley did with Marina Oswald is really interesting to listen to, and he's very graciously posted it on YouTube. So I encourage all of you to just go listen to it. He edited it down to 38 minutes, and it's a fascinating insight into a fascinating woman. I don't know that you'll be surprised by some of the things you'll hear, but I was taken by her intelligence, her grasp of very big conceptual global issues, and so forth. You know, there's no smoking gun soundbite in there about her husband, but I think you'll find it very, very interesting. So if you can find 38 minutes, go look for the Marina Oswald interview with Jefferson Morley online. So I can't tell you what to make of my Bradley experience. I was terribly disappointed that he didn't follow up, but shortly thereafter, you know, Bob Woodward got the assignment with Carl Bernstein, and they went off and deposed the president.
Have you had any since that time? Did you have follow-up conversations with Woodward about this topic?
I did, and this is now probably 7 years ago, so it's not kindly. But he was up in my area, and he agreed to meet with me, and I brought it up. And he's such a brilliant and articulate guy that I was no match for him. But he just sort of, my recollection is he just kept avoiding the conversation.
Well, where we know Bernstein is more inclined to believe there's a conspiracy, right?
So, and I think he was doing it as, you know, as a courtesy. I mean, I don't claim to have known him that well, but ever since that day, I've had several contacts with him, and it's just not a topic he's ever been interested in talking about with me.
Did you have a chance to talk to Bernstein?
No, never met him. It's just too long ago to remember who came in and out of the room, but it was in their big, huge conference room right on the ground floor with this massive glass window facing the sidewalk. And it was so distracting because they didn't, you know, people were walking by and in and out of the room. So even Woodward says, I'm pretty sure I was there, but he didn't remember and I couldn't confirm it. But I do remember certainly being introduced by my contact Simons to Ben Bradley, who was the managing editor of the paper at the time, and Catherine Graham came in the room, but I think she was only there for 10 minutes or so. So they had contact with it in 73. So, you know.
Well, I'm just saying, I think Bernstein is more amenable to that kind of thinking, and I was just curious if you – so you haven't had any opportunity to speak with Bernstein.
No. I think Carl Bernstein, I don't know about it. I think he's like 80, 81 years old, yeah. But I think he's still actively doing things.
Yeah. He's on TV.
Yeah. So
Bob, I'm glad that you mentioned Catherine Graham, because the McComb papers that were released, the John McComb papers, give us a very, very important document where the very next Tuesday, he goes into a meeting with LBJ, and LBJ is, complaining that the Washington Post, with their editor, Mr. Friendly, and Catherine Graham were planning, that Friendly was planning on publishing an editorial that was going to call for the most thorough investigation using the best judicial minds available at the time, okay? And that did not sit very well with LBJ. And he said, well, you know, guess what? I'm going to go ahead and call Catherine Graham. And he did. And he killed the editorial. And I'm talking about just a couple of days after the assassination. So that gives you an idea of the Washington Post and their position in all this.
The Catherine Graham family is a long, extensive and engaged family of success. I didn't realize Catherine Graham was involved in leadership at the Post in the 60s.
At that time, well, her husband had just died, a year prior to that.
I couldn't remember when her husband died, but she inherited it as a result of his...
He died the summer before the assassination.
Okay, I'm sorry. Thank you for... I just didn't have the time frame in my mind. Well, again, it's just a little anecdote, but see, this is the amazing thing. I can't think of anything more representative of the kinds of things that meetings like this do than what just happened in the last 2 minutes, where I make a passing reference to an experience that I happen to have had that didn't result in anything. It came up in another forum, in the JFK Facts Forum, in a related context, and then Larry just throws in a reference to another document that ties it full circle. So the web is so complex, and it is something that I don't think single minds can't embrace this. I think it requires group mind meld, if you will, to be able to put these things in a way that can be understood. And that circles completely back to this issue of how we educate the next generation. Those of you like Casey and others and Brian who teach, and particularly are in front of young people, if you're like me, it is hard to figure out how to approach going into a room, particularly with young people, and be selective on that half or one quarter of 1% of material that you have an opportunity to share with them with something as complex as this. That's something that I face in my mind all the time. And in fact, the presentation that I have has always been called the Warren Commission Report, Fact or Fiction. I can't use that anymore because nobody even knows what the Warren Report is. When I say nobody, young people don't. So I know a lot of people have used this euphemism of 101. David has already done that in some of his opening remarks, or 101, 102. And I may have to do that. And I don't want to misuse a phrase like that in a way that it puts off the potential audience. In other words, by saying JFK assassination 101, does that insult people's intelligence? So even how you label it, let alone how you bring people in the room and how you address a topic like this, in my case, I have, you know, 9 to 5 to do it, but if you're going to do it in an hour or two, it requires some thinking. So I'm always open to suggestions.
The primer, it could be a primer. It could be basic background.
I just dropped it in the chat.
Some people saying it's a 101. Like, it sounds like you're dumbing it down for them, right?
What I'm working now part-time as an author liaison for Crime Day, Chris Milligan. And when I'm working with the authors, they know their story.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Well, I mean, what kind of points it back to us is the fact that, you know, for the younger generation, it's an awakening. For the older generation, it's a reawakening. For the middle age group demographic, we're kind of in the program of, you know, life's too busy to bring on one more thing. And it's understandable, but eventually, you know, hopefully they will come to, you know, to the idea that, you know, they'll come back and they'll start paying attention to what's going on. I think that's kind of where we're at with, you know, the demographics of it.
And so, David, again, this is, you know, I know you hate to go long, but that's the value of these programs, that there's a lot of spontaneity. People, you know, start, maybe takes an hour and a half before something clicks, and then suddenly, right. So
all of a sudden it takes a mind of its own, and
yeah,
we go on
yeah.
it. That's what I love about the journey meetings. I mean, I know I get asked questions from some people, well, do you have guest speakers lined up? Everybody's a guest speaker when it comes to this, you know. I mean, we have I've done it both ways, where it's like I try to make it structured, I've tried to make it where it's just, you know, water cooler talk, and some of the best comments that I get on the YouTube channel is the ones where it's not scripted. It's, you know, fly by the seat of your pants, and that's where some of the great information comes out, because you're sharing the ideas. Larry, you got your hand up.
Yeah, I just dropped the web post there on the McCone thing, and in the Washington Post. It's towards the end there for those who want to check it out. All right, and you know, it's been out there already for a while. And it's like I was telling Mal, you know, if there's any good example of burying the lead, all right, this is it.
I like it.
All right.
Yeah, I've got to reach out to Mal. I'm going to see about if I can get him in. He's running. I know I talked to Denton a couple weeks ago. I think he's running for Congress or something.
Who?
Mal Hyman. I think Mal's running for Congress, but I want to say it was Congress or Senate or something. I can't remember which one it was, but I think he was running for a government office. And I've liked Mal ever since I met him the first time in Olney at David's College. And I'm going to see if I can see about getting him to either be in person or on Zoom for the spring conference. And if Larry's available to come to KC, you know, I wouldn't mind having Larry. He's always got great information. I know I'm working on trying to get Ryan Jones to.
I am now.
Oh, you're going to come to Kansas City, are you?
Yeah.
All right. Well, there you go. There's another one I just added. And if I can extend out the time more than just, you know, where I've only got 7 hours of speaking time. I can get some donations to help pay for some more of the conference time. I can always add more hours in. I mean, I don't want to be going from 9 in the morning till 10 at night. But if I could add in a few hours, you know, each day or even 2 hours each day, it would help out to where we can, you know, have some more opportunity for more speakers.
Could I just share one other thing?
Yeah, go ahead, Bob.
I just, first of all, Larry, thank you for sharing the McCone document. I appreciate it. I hadn't gotten to that RIF number yet. Joe put up the Marina interview. So there you go. You can grab it in the chat. Just bear with me. Larry Schnapp has already heard this story, but it's so funny. I've been trying to keep up with the release documents by going to Mary Farrell and clicking on RIF numbers and trying to read through things. And I got a phone call about a month and a half ago from Gary Shaw, and he said, have you read the following RIF number? And I can't say that I had. So he said, you ought to go look at it. So I brought it up and read it. And I had to get a chuckle out of it. I'd made mention, at least to David and some other people, that I worked with Bud Fensterwald for decades and was a member of the Committee to Investigate Assassinations, which is how I got hooked up with Gary and Richard Sprague and all that crew, and how I started doing research. So we put together a conference at Georgetown University Law School in November of 1973, and it was appropriately called Decade of Assassinations. And this RIF document was written about that conference, including detailed information about the speakers. And it was clearly done by somebody who was there in the room. And this is the place where I showed the enhanced Robert Groden version of the Zapruder film for the very first time. This was long before it ended up on Aralo Rivera and so forth. Gary remembers it vividly. And here's the punchline to this, that why Gary called me. He said, well, there you are in the document. And I said, okay. This is in the context of the fact that when I give presentations at colleges, they always ask me, this is just the inclination of younger people, you know, do you ever feel at risk personally? Has anybody ever done anything to you? And I have been the indirect victim of various things. People who want to shut you off often don't attack you. They attack your family and friends. And I already outed the two FBI people who had been assigned to me in the Albany office. And I actually outed them at a presentation at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs. So this document that Gary points out to me, I read it. It's a report on this conference and the speakers and me and several other people. And you'll never guess who the document was written by, the person who came to the room and who it was sent to. It was written by no other than James Jesus Angleton, the super spy. So back this is 1973. So back in 73, he took time from being the ghost and the nation's super spy to actually go out and surveil U.S. citizens. And the document was directed to Director of the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover. So it's only relevant anecdotally to the notion of the cover-up, in the sense that even citizens like those of you, there's 40 names still online. There were, I think, well over 50 at its height today, David. It's not unreasonable for agencies that have no mandate to do so to be monitoring the behavior of each and every one of us. And the running joke, right, is that people say, do you feel paranoid? I say, well, I wouldn't feel that way unless I knew everybody was out to get me. And that is sort of a comic relief way of saying that, you know, this stuff's going on. And whether they have the wherewithal, resources, people, or interest to do that today with any of you or me, I do not know. But I found it a little enlightening that, you know, that I've used up my entire 15 minutes of fame, of which almost all of it was divided between the FBI and the CIA. And all I was doing was going out and talking about it. That's all I was doing. So there's an object lesson maybe in there. I don't know.
Well, you know, Bob, even a paranoid person can have someone following them.
You know, I guess. It's funny, we laugh about this because this is sort of this bizarre black humor, but I think the harder we laugh at it, like a comment that Larry just made, the more likelihood that there's truth in it. And although we're probably not here to discuss and solve the problem of, you know, of internal surveillance of citizens, we, you know, I mean, we already know that the FBI was outed back in the 70s by its surveillance, and certainly what surfaced about, you know, focused around Dr. King and how pervasive it became. You know, here it was, some college graduate in upstate New York who was going around the country talking to very large audiences, and the CIA decides they need to send somebody out in addition to the FBI. Not that those two agencies ever talk to each other, but I get comic relief in it now, and so I hope that you all accept it not as a puff piece or, you know, self-serving, but more just this is the real story. So Casey and David and Larry, I wonder if you guys, each of you might even merit an entire file cabinet drawer, each of your own.
Well, I tell you what, anytime you're online like this, you can always seem to end up on somebody's radar. So,
well, at least I can tell you this from my point of view. I'm sure I had a file back when I was in the military, at least back in 1972 and 1973, because I got called into the commanding general's office, and they wanted to shut me down. And I just said, so 24/7, am I part of your organization? They go, yeah, you are, but your wife wasn't issued. And then right about that particular time, I said, so why are you calling me in? Well, because you're appearing at a couple of universities and speaking on the murder of John F. Kennedy. And I said, and that's a problem with you guys in the military? And little did I know that my research years later would cover some of the same people that I was talking to. But at the same time, yeah, I'm sure they had a file on me. And I'm sure they have a file on everybody in here. And I would hate to see what they have on Larry Schnapp. So.
Well, while Bob was talking in Washington, I was publishing a six-piece series in the Rutgers Targum, the daily newspaper for Rutgers, at that same time accusing the CIA of killing the Kennedy. So I'm probably right up there with Bob.
You probably are. I'll tell you, in 1970, I was the student body president of Emporia State University, and I had the opportunity to introduce Vincent Bugliosi to our campus, and I had the opportunity to, of course, he was talking about the Tate-LaBianca murders and good old Charlie Manson, and I had the opportunity to walk him off stage and sit with him for about an hour waiting for a car to take him to the Wichita Airport, and you know, the first thing I asked him, I said, so you personally believe and you have information that Charles Manson killed a lot of these people? And he goes, no. I said, so you believe that there was a conspiracy involved in this? And he goes, well, yes. I said, so no conspiracy involved in John Kennedy's assassination and also Robert Kennedy's assassination and Martin Luther King? And I started just going down the list. And he goes, no. He says, Those were all lone nuts. And I said, based on what? I mean, you're the district attorney of L.A., and then you're telling me that, you know, so on and so forth. But I did have the opportunity for about an hour to pick his brain, and I sat back and I said, you know, one of these days he's going to write a book. God bless that he write a book. But
did you get a sense when you in talking to him that he was one of these false patriots?
Yes.
Yeah, it was all about America. It's all about protecting America's honor.
That was it. Yeah.
I had a similar experience with Arlen Specter back in one of Cyril Weck's first conferences at Duquesne, where there was a unplanned window of opportunity. And although he spoke I would say eloquently in defense of his theory to this group of JFK researchers, and he was not jeered or disrespected, but he did not offer any defense to his theory at all. He just didn't even want to engage in the conversation of anything other than, yeah, this is what happened, and read about it in the Warren Commission report. So, I wasn't savvy enough to gauge false patriotism or anything like that, other than the point that he was now senator. But I found his response to be very, you know, profoundly disingenuous, and to the point that Gerald Posner often really causes me to cringe at times. He has never changed his point of view, but he speaks, I don't even know how to describe it, almost in a patronizing way to critics.
He can't change his view because he has a book that's still being sold.
Yeah.
Or if he did anything, if he had any opinion that would contradict his book, he'd probably be in violation of his publishing contract.
But he doesn't. But he gives lip service to those who disagree with it.
Right. He goes as far as he can, but you know, I'm sure he has to. He has an obligation to his publisher. He can't be truthful. He'll do as far as he can, but he can't. Even if today you gave him something that he believed, it showed him that there was a conspiracy, he could probably agree with you privately, but he has never admitted publicly. Yeah. Does that undermine his book?
Yeah. I find Casey's comments about your experience with Bugliosi to be right on line. I found, at least, again, I never met him or knew him, and I just read his stuff, but I just did not understand his mindset, being an accomplished, you know, law enforcement official in a huge American city. It just, his logic escaped me. I couldn't find any logic in it.
One of the problems we have in our case is there's a judge that wrote a book, The Trial of Lee Harvey Oswald, right? He's a sitting judge in San Francisco, and he basically shows that if there was a trial, Oswald would have been convicted. I'm sure this guy's having lunch with our judge and probably poisoning him with thoughts.
Let me throw this out, because I know when Brian and I were doing research on our book, at least one of our books, about Ed Hoffman, and we decided to take Ed Hoffman out and have him stand on Stemmons Freeway and show us where he was standing right there. And he told us, he says, nobody's ever done this before. And I said, okay. I said, you do know these cars are going by 70 miles an hour. And he goes, well, he says, I can feel the vibrations. I see. He says, I can't hear them. And so to me, I was more afraid of cars hitting us and cars going by. And as he was standing there, he looked over the edge and he could see where Stemmons Freeway, started and where, the bridge or the tunnel under Stemmons Freeway opened up, and he stopped, and I said, what's going on? And, of course, we had to have all these interpreters with us because I don't speak ASL, and neither does Ed. That's the problem, American Sign Language. But he said, you know, he says, I just remembered something. He says, I brought something out before, but he says, I'm not really sure if the president was lying on the seat or if he was lying on the floor. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, this me being out here and present here brought back some memories that I didn't realize I had before. But he thought that the president may have been lying on the floor and that he saw Jackie Kennedy trying to get around the president and shaking his body, and he could see the back of the president's head. But at the same time, I just sat back and I said, this is new information that we've never had published before, anybody's right. Talked about. So,
and now we know that there's a second agent in the car, Casey.
Absolutely.
Hey, Casey, a question came up on the Morley podcast the other day. Do you know anything about whoever originally spoke with Hoffman from the government did not have the same, the adequate sign language skills. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, that the agents that did speak with him did not have those skills, and they did not have anybody there in the office that spoke those skills, or at least the interpretation. So they just they hounded him off basically as the, you know, they don't understand. And to me, I would sit back saying, you know, you have an eyewitness here. You need to provide something very quickly. At least that's what I would think.
Some point down the road, there was a person that from the government that had some sign language skills, but not the type that he had a certain type of training, a certain type of, there's more than one type of signing language or something.
Well, I can tell you that we brought in a couple people, but then we also had to bring in his daughter. His daughter is the one who did most of the interpretation. And it was before the ASL, American Sign Language, was actually brought into existence, as far as I know. And then so he had some skills, but only his daughter could
understand. His daughter was with him in the episode of The Men Who Killed Kennedy. She's the one that's doing it. Yeah.
And Ed tried to tell us. I said, Ed, so you saw the guy walk down the line? He goes, no. He says, I didn't say walk. He ran down the fence line. And I said, well, that wasn't interpreted in the Men Who Killed Kennedy. It says that he walked briskly or whatever. And he goes, no, he says he ran. So the interpretation even of his daughter and how it was portrayed in that particular film was incorrect. So when Ed was back there, I just sat back and I go, you got to be kidding me. So Brian and I, what we did is we had our watches, and what we did is we timed ourselves running behind the picket fence to where Ed said he saw this guy drop off a rifle. And, you know, I was a lot younger at that time, but I could travel that area probably within 5 or 6 seconds. And I got to thinking, I go, well, where is everybody looking in that 5 or 6 seconds? Well, most of them are not looking behind the picket fence. They're looking at the car. They're looking at the president. They're looking at Jackie Kennedy. So would they have seen anybody back there? Well, Ed can't see the president at the time. He saw the car, but he said that he saw this guy, and he tried to point out to us that he said he ran. He ran from behind the picket fence and dropped off the rifle to a waiting gentleman there that broke it down, put it in a bag. But at the same time, you're not going to get that information, like most of you are saying, unless you actually talk to people and get down to the nitty gritty. And, you know, I think one of the most interesting things we came across, we were down there for 2 solid weeks, and I asked Ed, I said, would you please come through the door as if you were coming in that day and trying to communicate with your father? And he said, yes, we'll do that. So he comes through and he starts signing. And I said, no, you weren't signing. You were trying to sign. This is what you said. I said, you were trying, and you told us that you were trying to talk, which he could do up to about age 4. But at the same time, he says, okay, he says, I'll do that. So he came in and he started doing stuff. He started doing sign language, but he was also going, I said, holy crap. I mean, that amazed me, because I had to do some education on what deaf people could actually say, who said it, how they said it, how they interpreted it. And when I started writing stuff down to give to Ed years before this, I found out that they don't write the same way that we do. And it's a whole different language. It's as if you're studying German and you have the predicates and everything before and after. And I just sat back and I said, oh my God. I said, we're on to something here, but I said, I'm not sure how to interpret it. So when we were going through this with Ed, we had to do it several times in order for him to be able to tell us exactly what's going on, and most of the time we pivoted off of his daughter's interpretation, and his daughter basically said, yeah, sometimes he means this, this is what he says, this is what he doesn't mean, and it was part of the American Sign Language, but it was, I don't want to say like old school, but I'm not sure exactly what it was, but he did have some sign language courses, but not the kind that they had in American Sign Language.
One thing I'm going to throw up on the screen here real quick that backs up what Casey was just talking about. When you look at the line of sight, and this is just right after the, you know, the fatal headshot, when you look at the people on the bridge, you know, where, you know, they could have easily looked over and seen, you know, these people running from, you know, the grassy knoll down to throw the rifle. Nobody, especially on the bridge, is paying a damn bit of attention to that. They're all looking down on Elm Street, not aware of what's going on behind the picket fence, not aware of what's going on anyplace else. You know, they're worried about, you know, when you follow their line of sight. Let me see if I can blow this up any. Let me see here. Yeah, here we go. When you look at the line of sight, okay, this guy here is looking over, but is he looking, you know, he obviously can't see behind the bridge that low on Elm Street. And all your people up on the bridge, where they're looking at, and you trace their line of sight down, they're looking down on Elm Street. They're not paying a bit of attention to what Ed's seen from the Simmons Freeway and what's going on behind the grassy knoll. So, you know, it's one of those things where there's could be a possible shooter on the bridge. They're not even paying attention to that guy. They're all looking down at where the limo was just at.
Armalite.
Yeah,
hey, Bob. Well, David, don't forget that we have the Knoll Rider that was also drawing a lot of attention, you know, towards the country steps there, you know, and that, you know, must have been quite a sight.
What shocked me was, you know, you had all the researchers, and I'm not trying to tip my own hat, but in a minute I'm going to anyway, you know, all the reenactments that were done, and here you got an eyewitness that, you know, came forward, you know, tried to come forward and, you know, was talked about even in the Men Who Kill Kennedy. And I've watched that several times. Nobody did a reenactment of where Ed was, you know, what Ed saw coming underneath that bridge until we were down there filming I was filming a commercial for Robin Brown and his JFK Custom Tours. And Casey and Brian were down there helping me. And so was my buddy Jason. And I said, you know what? We need to go over and film from, you know, where the Ed Hoffman position is and see where the car came out from, which, of course, we use those photographs in Larry's book, and we're going to put them in the new version of Beyond the Fence Line. It just shocked me that all these different places were reenacted or, you know, they'd went and taken photographs or video. And here's one of the perfect eyewitnesses to the assassination, and nobody gave a shit to go over and see if they could prove his story wrong. You've got your case closed Posner that, you know, came out and, you know, bullshit his way through the, you know, the signage and the trees and everything else. But did he take a car? It could have been any car. We just happen to have, you know, a smaller, you know, Lincoln convertible to go over there and see it come out with Brian and Heather Fear in the back seat riding. And, you know, up to that point, nobody had done that. And I know, what Casey was saying a while ago, I know I was sitting there on the Jersey wall, and you could, I mean, you've got traffic coming by 70 to 90 miles an hour, and luckily I didn't get sucked into the highway. I didn't get sucked off on Simmons Freeway, by the semi, but I could have, and, you know, because I was using all my senses to pay attention to what was going on, but I wasn't going to miss that shot either. So
I was going to say that, to your point, nobody wanted to do any reenactments, you know, and the very latest was when Douglas Horn had the Bell and Howell right there, almost ready to do it. And at the 11th hour, it never happened. You know, the Orville Nix camera gets confiscated by the FBI. When they return it, it's in pieces, you know, of useless value. You know, the Austin 6, nobody went over there and let's see, you know, how these people accommodate in the doorway. Yeah, I mean, come on. It's across
the board. I mean, you want to talk about investigation-wise, you know, they reenacted certain aspects that fit the story that they wanted to put out.
Of course. Yeah.
but the other locations and, you know, reenactments that could have been done to make this a proper investigation was never thought of. And, you know, I made that video, what, probably 8 or 10 years ago. But nobody had went over there and made that reenactment, whether it was I took photographs of it before, but I had the idea of doing the video clip, and I'm glad I did, because it really showed the fact of what Ed said that he saw, he could see, because Posner came out and said there's no way he could have looked down a limousine, whether it's from his perspective or whether it was too far away or whatever the case was.
Right.
Yeah. And I proved the fact, yes, Ed could see what he claimed to have saw, at least with the car coming out of the limousine. And obviously, if you have read Brian and Casey's book, with the way the vegetation was growing behind the grassy knoll and up from the Stimmons going over to that area, at the time, with the way that as the height goes for the vegetation, the trees, the bushes, and so on, he had a perfect bird's eye view of where he was at, and he wasn't paying attention to sound. He couldn't hear. He wasn't paying attention to anything else other than, you know, using his eyes. And any time that you take one sense away, your other senses compensate and get that much stronger. So
how many times do you think Posner went down to Dealey Plaza to do reenactments?
Well, in all honesty, I don't know if he actually went down there and took any reenactment photos at all. I mean, you know, when you're like that and you're writing a book, and you're put out by a major publisher, I'm sure you get a team to go, hey, guess what? We need photographs of this. We need photographs of that. Go take this. I mean, him personally going down there, I'd love to sit down and ask him and just see the look on his face, go, hey, did you go over to Ed Hoffman's perspective and actually run a car underneath the bridge? Because here's what I did. And, you know, in your book, you said this. I mean, you can attack somebody all damn day long.
Hey, even Brian, for example, Brian goes to Dealey Plaza and just happens to, by happenstance, get access to the railroad control tower, you know, and goes up there, you know, and takes pictures of it, you know.
Yeah.
It, you know, that happens only, you know, when you're really doing an investigation, you know.
Yeah, you got to be in the right place at the right time. And, you know, I remember seeing the video of Jim Mars going in that building, into Bauer Herrero Tower. But, you know, when Brian sent me those photographs, I said, you've got to be shitting me. You know what I mean? We had to definitely put those on the website, and they are. But, you know, it's a thing that you uncover as the years go by, in this case. And sometimes you're a first generation researcher, second, third, fourth, or whatever. But again, I mean, it takes what's been done before and build on that, or to throw the baby out with the bathwater and start over again.
David, let me interrupt and throw out a couple things for food for thought, because this is what I'm looking into. I just got material information last night. You know, I kind of laughed at it a little bit. I said, but you know what? Let's look at this information. I've been told that there's at least one or two possible photographs taken, and they're famous photographs, but they were taken and they show Zapruder standing on the wall there with Marilyn Sitzman, but in the background, one of the two photos shows that there is an opening at the corner of the fence, and that opening is probably about 3 foot wide, and that if you look in some other photographs, you will find that there's picket fence, brand new, put in later on. And I kept looking at this, and I said, what are you trying to say? And I said, well, there's one photograph that shows that fence was open, and that the drainage gutter or the grate that was behind the picket fence.
You're talking about where the picket fence joins with the overpass there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's been altered, of course. Yeah.
Okay. But here's the thing. They said it was open. And so you didn't have to go down, and stand behind the fence and shoot. You could just shoot from that gutter. And I'm sitting there going, okay. So if a lot of these pictures and photographs have been altered, maybe that's been altered. And I can tell you this, the first year that I took students to Dallas, the first thing we did is we sat for 5 hours next to that fence, the wooden fence that joins the railroad bridge, the triple underpass. We sat there for 5 hours watching cars go by, and I said, you know, this would be a perfect shot right from here. And so I've never kept that out of our mind in that situation. But at the same time, now new material's being brought up, so now I got to research it. But
well, also, don't forget that Beverly Bronson, you know, she said in late 60s, everything has been altered, you know?
Absolutely. That's right, Larry. And here's the other thing. And I'm not sure if I'd have to go back and look in our book if we actually put this there, but we asked Ed if there were any trains, if there was any trains going by during the assassination. And he goes, yeah, there were. And I said, I showed him the photographs, and I said, there are no trains that you can see here. And he says, well, there was a train going by. He says, there might have been one or might have been two. And I said, what do you mean? He says, well, during the assassination, he saw two trains going by, one going one way, one going the other. And so I didn't have the photographic material to be able to show him, but other than the fact that we saw no trains up there. But if you're looking at the possibility of manipulation of these photos, then that could easily have been manipulated. But
Fred Newcomb published an article called "The Last Train Dealey Plaza," in which he said and he proved that the Willis photo. If you look at the background there, you know, the blocks there, you know, where you're supposed to see through, you know, and. You know, there's no train in one of the photos, but there's a train in another one, you know, where it was obvious that it had been altered to remove the evidence of the train there.
Yeah, there's there's some interesting information. Like, for instance, when we were putting out the book, I had to go into the railroad itself and find out, obviously, that's a switching yard up there, and that railroad tower is a switching tower. And Bowers had access to throwing tracks, opening the tracks up, and then some of them were manual. You had to open the tracks up manually. Again, at the same time, we counted at least 14 tracks that were on top of the railroad bridge, and that two of them on the outside, on the north side, were main line tracks, where those were open all the time, and there was a speed limit of probably 25 to 30 miles an hour, and those were your main lines where trains would come through. And so we took all sorts of pictures and tried to blow those things up as to where, and of course, if you guys know what a way car is, it's a caboose, okay? I don't think they have those on trains anymore. But they used to have a caboose or a way car that would be the end of a train, and it had your control people in there that would control and talk to the not only the conductors but also the engineer. So we had to look at those things too. But it was interesting that Ed basically said he saw maybe one and maybe two trains going over the track. Well, the Warren Commission threw that out by saying, no way, the Secret Service would have made sure that those tracks were clear. Really? Well, there was about 14 or 15 people standing on the railroad bridge. Did they make sure that those guys were off the bridge? In fact, even the driver and assistant driver in the car basically with Kennedy's limo said, well, we didn't even notice that there was people up there. And then all of a sudden they come back and they go, well, there were people up there. So what was it? I mean, we have pictures that show you that there's 12 to 14, 15 people up there. But, you know, did the Secret Service scour that area? Well, if they did, they didn't do a very good job of that. Of course, we could go on for hours about whether the Secret Service did or did not do a very good job. So, but anyway, I thought I'd throw those out because that's what I'm starting to look at right now. Some of those photos taken by Willis and several of the other people who were down there that day that show the background that maybe the fence was not intact entirely, even at that particular time, and that it was put there later on to show that the fence was already intact.
Well, I want to throw this out. what's going to make what makes it hard for us as researchers is the fact of, you know, we know that there was films and photographs that were altered back at the time of the assassination. What makes it harder for the kids of today or the younger generation of researchers is not only they're dealing with that, but some photographs, you know, with AI can now be manipulated in a whole different aspect. And I think it's done mostly to, you know, either discourage or to just flat out, you know, make it to where they, you know, it's too big of an item to tackle. So don't try. And that's the whole point of, you know, letting the younger generation know it's not too late for the truth. It's not too late to start researching. And just because this has been, you know, 60 plus years, you still have an opportunity and a need to locate the truth and to find it out no matter where it's hidden at.
I just put that article in the chat there for whoever wants to check it out by Fred Newcomb.
Thank you, Larry.
All right.
Well, I tell you what, guys, we are at the 5 o'clock time here in the Central Time Zone. So I think what we're going to do is I think it's a good point to wrap up for the day. And then we will be back next month. Sorry again about missing January. But we'll be back next month with another journey meeting. And I will be working on getting the spotlight presentation scheduled. I want to get a spotlight scheduled for the Chokeholds book, also for Ricky White, his book of Admitted Assassin with Gary and Brian. Keep searching for the truth and keep your nose in those books, whether they're printed or they're digital. We'll have some more information coming out on the April conference, so look for that on the ProjectJFK.com website. Remember,
your representatives.
Oh, yes. Definitely do the representative thing. Like I say, you can email that to Larry or to me. And then if you email it to me, I'll forward it to Larry. What's that, Larry?
Or put it in the chat right now.
Or in the chat right now if you know who your representative is, and I'll email the chat log over to Larry. But like I say, guys, it's a pleasure getting together. Discussing what we discuss in these meetings. They're vital for the research. They're vital to the people that aren't here. They're vital to the people that watch our videos on YouTube. And remember, if you get an opportunity, look at the videos that are posted, and sometimes there's questions in there that people ask. If they don't get an answer back, I try to answer as many as I can, but there's some questions that I can't answer because they're directed directly to one of you that's in the room here during the meeting. If we don't answer their questions, then they may go away, and we don't want that. I know sometimes I'm bad at answering emails, and Bob, I do want to throw out an apology to you. I have gotten your emails, but I have been extremely busy. But I want to let you know that they don't fall on deaf ears. I just have a hard time getting back to everybody in a decent or short amount of time. Sometimes it takes me a few days, and sometimes it's taken me a few months. Again, the conference information will be coming out. I hope to see as many of you in Kansas City as possible. And like I say, if we get the Zoom portion to go, then if you don't get a chance to come to Kansas City, meet us on Zoom, but I'm trying to keep the cost low. It's definitely probably going to be, I know for a fact it's going to be cheaper than going to the Dallas conference. And there's nothing wrong with the Dallas conference. I mean, you're just going to a different city that charges a hell of a lot more money for everything. So if you guys like what we're doing, donate to us. If you can donate to help out the conference in Johnson County, in April, it would be greatly appreciated. Maybe we can add some more hours on, and maybe we can add some more speakers on. So that not only benefits us as a group, but it also benefits the students to hear from as many researchers and experts as we can. With that, I think we're gonna wrap up this meeting, and then we'll see you again in March. So thank you everybody for coming out, and stay safe, keep researching, and if you have questions, you can always reach me at projectjfk@yahoo.com, or you can reach out to me by phone 913-980-JFK1 or 5351. So I'm David Knight, your host of the Journey Meeting with Project GFK CSI Dallas, along with Casey Quinlan and Brian Edwards. Have a great rest of the weekend and a good week next week.
Go Lions.
Go Chiefs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.